Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's January 17th, 2021, and welcome to episode 229 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and a new year. So here we are. We've made it. It's 2021. Everything is different. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston. I'm joined by several retro computing enthusiasts today. With me today are Quinn Dunkey from LA. How are you?
Everything is different, but not quite different enough.
Right. Yes. I guess you couldn't see my end tag sarcasm.
Yes. Yeah. Keep working at it, 2021. We need a little more differentiation there from 2020 still.
Yeah. Also joining us is Blake Patterson from Northern Virginia. How are you?
I'm good. I'm doing well. I'm just sitting here in sleepy DC, trying to do that retro thing. So, glad to be here.
Hiding out in the basement.
Should be a good week. Yeah, literally hiding out in the basement.
Also joining us is Jack Nutting from Stockholm. How are you?
Hello, I'm doing pretty well. Our winter turned into an actual winter-ish winter with snow and cold and stuff. So that's right. Better than just gray and rain.
Yeah. And lastly, Carrington Manston from Toronto. How are you?
Gray and rain. That's what Toronto is. I'm well. Toronto's gray and rain. I'm clear and no rain.
So, we debated a little bit what the topic would be before recording, and then decided actually what we were going to do, since there are so many of us and so many things to talk about. It's been actually quite some time since we recorded. I forget if it's 3 or 4 weeks, but it's been some large-ish number of weeks. So we're just going to talk about news and feedback and other stuff, and the topic will be catching up in 2021, I guess. Anyone want to talk about the weather first, though? Anyone who didn't?
We're having a heat wave in LA. It's crazy.
Oh.
It was 90 degrees the day before yesterday and 88 yesterday. That's like 40 in normal human degrees. So, yeah, it's very
January?
You're being serious? You're actually being serious?
Yeah, seriously. It was,
wow, that's crazy.
Crazy hot out there. I don't know why everyone's like, I don't know. Climate change, I guess.
Probably gonna die.
Yeah. I'm sure it's a sign of something terrible, but it's...
can't be good.
Yeah. I learned a couple of days ago that heat wave is one word.
Oh, I did not know that.
But it was on a game show, and you know, there was like a weather related word, and the first initial was H. And the answer was heat wave. And it was British, so maybe that makes a difference. I don't know. But okay. Going well here. So I guess the first thing we'll do, we skipped listener feedback kind of a lot recently, so we'll do some of the listener feedback to catch up. On the first one, I thought it was pretty interesting. On Facebook, we had David All posted on our Facebook group. So first of all, that's amazing.
Yeah. Creative computing.
Yeah, the founder of creative computing. I think we probably all have had, you know, books of basic games and things of his in front of us. But he posted on our Facebook group saying that he found the first issue of Byte, the first issue of Killabod, and he listed the ninth issue of Historically Brewed on eBay, and he's planning on listing these other ones too. So, and Historically Brewed is David Grealish's, you know, zine. So there's a connection. Anyway, I thought that was kind of cool.
I guess the first computer book I ever purchased was one of the, I think it was the red, there was a red one, a yellow one, a green one. I think it was like the number two. I bought it at a, you know, local bookstore, and basic programs. I came home and typed them in. And that's when I appreciated the book. I then learned that all basics are quite similar, but not exactly the same. So I had to figure out the TI variation of some of the things. But anyway, the most important thing, and I've talked about this in a number of places before, I would in middle school, they had in the tiny little microfiche slash periodicals closet, there were all these creative computing magazines ranging back until like from like 81, you know, this was 84 or so, 85. I subscribed to the magazine, but I read, you know, I skimmed through and read through all those other ones. So I learned, like, that's where I got the core of my knowledge of, like, the pre, you know, things that happened before I came on the scene that were, quote, home computing related. So, and, you know, he was the main force behind that. So I consider that, you know, quite a chunk of what put me into the, you know, gave me the interest in all of this. So, yeah, definitely hats off to David H. Al.
Yeah. Of course, it took us long enough to record this that the issue of Historically Brewed did sell for $36. I feel that it could have sold for more. Come on, people. but it's actually also sort of interesting that we now know what he sells under. So Katie Winston is the seller. But if you actually sort of read the description, it does say who he is. So there's also actually another auction that I saw, which was interesting, you know, that was also being sold on this same account, and it is Microphobia, cartoons by Martin Honeysett. And I thought it was just sort of interesting. I don't know these cartoons, but they do look like something that would appear in those magazines. Well, so first of all, it's being sold for, I mean, like, somebody could buy this. It's $4. But he says in the description that, you know, it's British humor. Yeah, the cartoons by Martin Honeysett are well drawn but very British, and most Americans will not find them very funny. Sorry about that. So
I feel like some large group of people is supposed to be insulted by that sentence, but I can't quite tell who.
Right.
But somebody.
Okay, I guess we can move on to the next bit of feedback. Stephen posted on Facebook about an Apricot F1. Do you guys know the Apricot F1?
Nope.
I do.
You do?
I do. I remember the Apple dealer in Williamsburg, Virginia, where I bought my first Mac and my 2GS. Yeah, they had this thing, the F1. It's your item. You can explain it. But I just remember it had Gem. They were running Gem bundled with it, and that little weird trackball. So it got caught my attention, and it's svelte little unit. Back when the Macintosh itself was kind of a svelte little unit, it seemed very odd that they were selling it in Southern Virginia. But anyway, I'll let you continue. I do remember.
Oh, these are feedback. They're not my items. So feel free to jump
well,
in.
You know, I'll just to continue a little bit, I guess the yeah, I think it was, I thought it was, looking back at it, it seems rather clever. It's nothing very special beyond, you know, it's a fairly standard PC. I think it's one of those sort of PC compatible 8086 or 8088 based machines, but it's not quite PC compatible, if I remember correctly. But the thing it definitely had going for it was you always saw it running a GUI, which was the Gem environment. Mm-hmm. And that really made it feel like, oh, you know, here's a Macintosh here, and oh, here's sort of a PC that did that. This is, you know, well before Windows. And the industrial design, I think, is really cool. The keys have a nice feel, and they've got that weird NCR looking, you know, cash register looking. It looks kind of like a Speccy 128 keyboard also, except for the color. But it always seemed like it would be nifty to have one of these. I didn't quite realize on the video stream, we're scrolling through images. I didn't quite recall the depth. It's quite a deep system. If you look at it from the front, it seems like a tiny little thing, but it has some, it's like 3 feet long or something, 3 feet deep.
That is strange. But, it looks small, but it's all a lie.
Yeah. You just have to go right now.
Yeah. It's, yeah. Not only is it like, it's like narrow widthwise and short, it actually gets much longer.
It gets taller in the back. Yeah, that's evil.
It's aerodynamic.
So it's really, Yeah, but I remember like being, you know, being there lusting for like a Macintosh, which I finally was able to get there at this computer dealer. It was called Next Generation Computers in Williamsburg. I remember a pleasant place. I spent hundreds of hours. I thought this was also something that Apricot in their presentation got me to lust after, and that was, you know, marketing that kind of worked. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I don't think it really. It didn't make a huge splash.
I feel like you would have to turn your desk sideways to put it on. Like you'd have to sit at the end of your desk.
Yeah, it's a strange. And Apricot also had they had a number of very. I guess the word that comes to mind is sort of elegant. They have a number of elegant PC compatibles and PC compatible-ish machines. They're kind of classily presented, I thought. Like some of the larger Apricots have like a little LCD in the keyboard, which gives you some contextual information. Not this one, not unlike Apple's, you know, Magic, whatever they call that bar,
Touch Bar.
Yeah, but Apricot always seemed like a kind of an interesting, innovative slant on it.
Interesting. Yeah, and I had never heard of them before, but.
Well, it's really weird that they had it at that dealership. I mean, I don't think it was a big America. I think it was mainly sold in Europe. I don't know how it is that we had it. I never saw another Apricot anywhere at any of the dealers, Computerland or, you know, what have you. But yeah, that one little, you know, one-off store had it.
Huh. Yeah, I took a look on eBay just to see if there were any. And actually, there is one seller that has two of them, and they are extraordinarily yellow. Anyway, it's kind of neat to see them. I think I wouldn't mind having one, but I'm not sure that I want to spend the, you know, like almost 300 euros for it. But I don't know. Anyway, okay. So that was kind of neat, new to me. In the Facebook post, Thomas Cherry Holmes said that they were evolutionary copies of the Sirius X1, aka Victor 9000. I didn't know that they were related to those, but apparently.
Yeah, apparently I'm just looking briefly. The company used to be ACT, and now they changed their name to Apricot. But yeah, it was British, founded in 1965.
Cool. Next feedback thing. It's kind of just a funny thing. Jack, did you see this?
Oh yeah, it's good.
Do you want to describe?
Yeah, so Tom Cherry Holmes and Kay Savitz running two Atari 8-bits across some great distance from each other. I don't know how many thousands of miles. Both using the FujiNet thing, running the same modded program to bounce a ball across between their two screens. It's pretty entertaining.
Yeah. So that's FujiNet being used.
And a nice proof
of
concept to how well this thing actually works.
Yeah.
Get out of the way, Kay. Also, I want to see.
Yeah. Also, we have podcast member Ken Gagne peeking in on the corner there.
Oh, right. Yeah, Ken's also there. There we can see it.
That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool.
It's pretty neat. Like, it's the kind of thing that you would expect, like, when you get that working on two machines side by side, you think, wow, this is really great. And then it's like, wait a minute, but this is the internet. Let's do it across the internet. Okay. It's fun.
Yeah.
Well, and it's worth noting that back in the day, that would have been mind-blowing. Like, that kind of communication over a distance was extremely difficult, extremely expensive, et cetera. So that would have been pretty cool.
Yeah. It would have been incredible. Yeah, I still have not bought a FujiNet. It's on my list of things I want to buy, but the hardware still is undergoing revision. I think they just are ramping up production of the version 1.3 of the hardware. So I'm going to let it settle down a little bit before I'll buy one.
Yeah. That sounds like the Osborne effect, right?
It's a very cool thing. No, but I mean, but they're selling plenty.
Okay.
So the people who are making, you know, in their homes, who are making these things, they seem to be selling out of them pretty often. So I don't think they're having any trouble selling the earlier versions either.
Hmm. Okay.
So it seems to be.
And they're quite inexpensive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So it's a really good price.
It's not like you're, you know, getting locked. You just shot that money down the toilet.
Right.
If there's a big upgrade.
Yeah, I've forgotten what it was, but it's 70 or 80 or something like that, right? I mean, it's something.
I don't think it's even that much.
Yeah, I think it's like 60 or something.
Okay.
It's pretty expensive.
Yeah, 59 or 60, yeah, I think.
Cool. Okay, let's see. Next thing. Yeah, Douglas posted to the Facebook group reviewing a homebrew MSX2 computer called the Omega home computer. What Douglas linked to was actually a kind of a review of the device. It is basically a two-board computer. One board is the keyboard. One board is the rest of it. That is essentially doing being an MSX2 computer. So it's a Z80 machine, the sort of standardized hardware platform that was used everywhere but the US, basically. So it's actually kind of, it's kind of an interesting video because you can tell that he's very excited about the ability to run an MSX computer. He was kind of pointing out that here in the US, at least, if you wanted to get an MSX computer, this is one of the better ways to do it, because if you get a vintage one, it's going to be PAL, it's going to be 220, unless you get it from Japan, in which case you can't read the keys, you know. But anyway, it's a pretty, you know, it's a cool video, 46 minutes, sort of going over what it's like and what it does. And the project itself is from, what's his name, Sergey Kislev. This is actually not somebody that I know, but he's done quite a lot of projects of this sort. Omega Home Computer is one of them.
He's got the whole project on GitHub here. I'm looking at it right now, and it's pretty fantastic. It's all open source. All the Gerbers are here, so you could send off and get your own boards if you want to build one. Anytime I see a project like this, I always immediately want to know how are they doing the graphics, because that's the hard part. And what's interesting is that it is using vintage chips. So it's using the V9958, which is the Yamaha graphics chip, this follow-up to the 9918. And it is also using their AY38910 audio chip. So some of these chips are pretty hard to get. Like that Yamaha 9958 is a bit unobtainium. You find them on eBay once in a blue moon, and you don't know if they work. So that would be the hard part of building one of these, but it's really cool. It's a very compact design, really nicely designed board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in Douglas's video, he was very, you know, he was sort of pointing out just how dense it is. I mean, like he had a suggestion about that. One thing he did not like about it was the power. Use one of these barrel connectors that you never know what the polarity is and how much, you know, voltage it's supposed to be. And but it was also, so he was pointing out that there's just no place to put anything else on this board. So anyway, it's kind of interesting. If you're interested in MSX at all, or interested in getting interested in it, it's kind of worth taking a look at this. And yeah, probably actually also his other projects.
I always thought it was interesting that, you know, MSX really had no presence at all in America, but it is a specification that was set out by Microsoft. You know, they created the MSX spec and the MSX2, and not for, you know, obviously not targeting the American markets, at least not initially. I don't know if they ever did, but it always seemed interesting to me. I had assumed that was, you know, not something that came from anything to do with an American-based company. Reading about it in the early creative computing magazine.
The subject of the power connector, honestly, I think that's a little bit of an unfair criticism there, because besides DC barrel jacks, if you need to get a lot of current into a homebrew device like this, there really aren't good options other than this. You can try to use a USB plug like modern devices do, but they're limited to 1 amp of current unless you have the negotiation chip. You have to have a host device chip on there that can negotiate higher current, and that's a whole system of its own. Or you have an onboard power supply and you have to deal with AC and mains current and isolation and transformers and stuff. So if you want an external DC supply that has high current capability, DC barrel jacks are kind of still the only option. They're so short of some sort of custom Molex connector or something. Mm-hmm. So yeah, keep that in mind if you're thinking about building a device like this.
Well, and I guess it does sort of seem like it is about as simple as such a thing could be. I mean,
right.
Yeah, and it's a stupid standard, and it's terrible, but it's the standard that exists. So you can go and buy a wall wart, you know, to that spec today still of any current and any voltage that you need, you know. So it's an easy solution to power supply, which is, you know, making the power supply is one of the more challenging aspects of a homebrew machine like this in a lot of ways. So it's an easy workaround.
We got an email from Sean that basically was talking about a desire to sort of stay off of networks as much as possible, you know, and not appreciating the like subscription mode software and things like that. But this sort of led into a discussion about LAN games. And anyway, Sean sent us this really kind of interesting spreadsheet, which is like a big list of Mac LAN games that are potentially of interest for playing on local networks, you know, like, so not over the internet.
there were a couple of years where some friends and I would get together. They were fellow Mac players, and so it was never a lot of Mac games, but we would like host LAN parties at each other's houses. So we'd come over, we'd all pick somebody's house, and say, oh, we're all going to David's house. We'd all lug over our early Power PCs and play Marathon or whatever. And like fantastic good times. I would do that again now, except one, I'd have to carry stuff to other people's houses, and two, I'd have to go see other people, and nobody's allowed to go outside anymore. So hooray for the internet.
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying. But Marathon was amazing.
Well, I would assume that a lot of the stuff that worked over LANs could be adapted to work over longer distances now, right?
Even back then, there was usually a remote network play thing. It was just like over modem, whatever, and crazy slow. Yeah. So I don't know if it would work well if you said, no, I'm giving you a really fast pipe. And it's, oh, no, I can't actually handle it. You weren't supposed to use me. I was just marketing. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, and the fun of the LAN party is that you're in the same room. So mm-hmm. you can... Yeah. You know, yell at each other and laugh and hear each other. And like we used to play, I guess the modern equivalent of that is the after hours office game. You know, at 3DO, we used to play Counter-Strike every day, pretty much after work. And it was awesome because we were all in the same cube farm. Mm-hmm. And so you could hear each other scream in agony across the floor and cheer and shout. And it was, I mean, it was awesome. And like, I never played Counter-Strike online on the internet because you're playing with randos and strangers and you're, you know, you can't hear anyone or see anyone, so it's just not the same at all.
Mm-hmm. Although I suppose, you know, I actually really don't play modern games, but I see on TV that people play modern games with headsets on, you know, talking to each other, which might be sort of simulating that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I did that a bit with Xbox Live, but again, like if you're not playing with people you know, it's not really fun because then you just get 12-year-olds screaming obscenities and homophobia in your ears, and it's like, oh, that's not good either.
Yeah, right. I prefer the obscenities screamed at me from my friends
exactly.
in Jason's room. Totally, of course. Yeah, I don't have a lot of experience with online stuff too because I'm aged out of it. Like you get to the point where he's like, at that point, I'm like, I'm 40 years old. These 12-year-olds are all twice as Twitch sensitive as I am. And they're saying bad things about my mom. Like this isn't as fun as the experience I wanted. The only experience like that I did for quite some time and enjoyed was early on playing World of Warcraft. Like I was a big fan of Warcraft at first, back vanilla Warcraft, and it was great. And so you join a guild, and so I had pals online, and I was like Felicia Day, but less popular. You know, that's me. So.
Yeah, so in the email, Sean actually said that, you know, what I've realized is that there are a lot of LAN games available, certainly for the Mac, and more so for the PC. So he's made this spreadsheet. That was the intro to the spreadsheet that he made. But it is true that the spreadsheet is big. You know, it's in a very small font, and it goes on for a couple of pages.
I didn't know there were any non-Marathon Mac LAN games.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Most of the first-person shooter things, Damage Incorporated, Prime... something, that one, they're all based on the Duke Nukem stuff. Duke Nukem as well, all LAN games. And Total Annihilation.
Didn't Spectre VR, that tank game, have LAN capability? I never had anyone on a LAN to play with. But it's that weird wireframe tank game, you know what I mean?
I played a lot of Spectre. It had the ability to put a QuickTime video on billboards in the level, which was the coolest thing ever in 1995 or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, man.
But did it have LAN support?
I don't know. Exactly. I only ever played it solo.
Yeah, me too.
It had a very cool box.
Yes,
it did indeed.
Angular,
I remember.
Yeah, it was a neat game.
Angular.
Yep.
But that's a game for which I actually saw and owned the box.
Oh my goodness! One of those.
Yeah.
I had a commercial copy of that as well. Actually, played it on my 660 AV. Which I say just so Carrington can get excited with me about the 660 AV.
Exactly right. People don't understand how good that computer was.
So good, you don't know. Oh. Nobody knows. Yeah.
You don't know, you kids. No.
Okay, so let's see. We've got the 660 AV. We've mentioned Case Abbott's.
I feel like I see our bingo cards early.
Totally.
Yeah.
Drinking game.
I found a PX8, but I didn't. I took it out of my eBay lists.
So. But you mentioned it now, so. There you go.
Yeah. So there you go. Okay, let's see. Well, okay, so here's maybe one more thing I'll say. Charles wrote to point out that in some ways the Newton did have a hand in saving Apple. I think we had made some comment about the idea that the hope was that the Newton was going to save Apple, but it just, you know, sort of was misplaced in time.
Yeah, let me speak to this one a little bit because I really like this email that, yeah, we were poking fun at the fact that anyone ever thought Newton was going to save Apple. But Charles points out that Apple did invest heavily in ARM early on and kind of used the company as a value store for 10 years or so, and then kind of cashed out, and then used, after ARM grew successful, they cashed out and used the money to buy Next. And so that's and then, you know, buying Next is ultimately what saved the company, arguably. So I think that that's kind of a neat way to look at that. And this also gives me an excuse to say my favorite joke about the home computer wars. People always argue about who won the home computer wars. Some people say IBM did because, you know, PCs are dominant. And other people say Apple did because Apple's really the only company that still makes home computers from those days. And I always say, no, the answer is Acorn, because we're all using billions and billions of ARM devices now. So Acorn won the home computer wars.
Yep.
Yeah, the Archimedes. Yep,
you're not wrong.
You could make the argument that Steve Jobs hated the Newton so much he came back to Apple just so he could cancel it, and then Apple thrived. So maybe the Newton did that. Maybe it was actually like a secret Steve Jobs bring him back Skunk Works program. You don't know.
Well, I'll mention one more thing because it's just quick, which is that Steven posted on our Facebook page a little while back that he had gotten done replacing the foam pads on his Compact Portable successfully. And I think, you know, I just wanted to remind people that keyboards were made with foam pads that deteriorate. And so if you want to do this on one of your own keyboards, Stephen on the Facebook page has done it and knows how bad it is.
Thanks.
I think this came up before too, that the Lisa also has a keyboard that has this.
I'm not looking forward to. I'm actually afraid. It's been like a year since I've touched my Lisa's keyboard, and I'm kind of afraid to press it and see if it's time.
Yeah.
Maybe it's soon.
Well, I wonder if the foam deteriorates and you press it, does that just mean that you wind up with just a mist of dust?
Depends on the mode of deterioration. Which, some, you know, petrochemical products either become dust or they become goo. And if the latter, it's a giant mess. But if the former, well, just mash all the keys and then vacuum it out and take it apart and replace the foam.
Right.
If goo, well, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. I guess we can move on. I'll leave the rest of the feedback that we got for later. But we made it through some. Good job, us. And now we can move to the items of interest and news. And Blake, you have the first of these.
Okay. Yes, the first thing that I am going to talk about is it's an add-on device for the Amiga 1000, actually, specifically. There's been a lot of enhancements over the years for the Amiga, you know, 500, the 2000, all the slotted Amigas have, you know, plenty of add-ons that are available to them. But so a device has recently, it's now shipping. It was available for pre-order only recently, and it's called the Amiga 1000 Parceiro, which is Portuguese for partner. You know, Amiga, you know, is Spanish for friend, or, you know, female.
Oh,
friend.
Now I get it.
So it's your All friend.
Right. I didn't get the name of this product.
Your friend's partner. And it's, you know, so it's got... what it is, it's a very small circuit board that slots into the Amiga 1000 side bus. It has a CPU bus sitting on the right side, and it basically exposes, you know, full connection to the CPU, and that's how you expanded things in sidecar fashion on the Amiga 1000. So it attaches to this bus. It has no pass through as some of the others do. So, but you could put it on the end if you have other devices that have pass throughs. And what it provides is 8 megs of RAM. It's actually SRAM, so it's slightly faster with zero wait states than the DRAM that is typical from the time of the day for expansion on the Amiga. And 8 megs is the largest capacity of RAM that the Amiga will support, the way its address bus is configured. So it's about as, you know, as fast as you can get RAM-wise. It has a real-time clock with battery, which is a nice thing. Was not standard on Amigas for some time, certainly not the 1000. And it has storage. It has it accepts an SD card, which is, it plugs into a little slot on the front of this device, and there's It's hard to see in any of the photographs, but there's a little indentation in the 3D printed case that comes with it that sort of mimics the floppy drive's rectangular indentation for your hands. It's just a cute little touch. Anyway, so you plug it into your system. Oh, and actually, it's worth noting there's, for the people watching the live stream, I'm showing images here. There's a great deal of very fun retro text that's been silkscreen printed onto the circuit board. There's by the connector says, "I'm just a 16-bit bus in a 64-bit world." There's some a series of resistors or some such that are labeled the Codon Armada, you know, from the last Starfighter.
There's Cyberdyne systems, I see.
Yeah, flux capacitor. You've got OCP directive, Cyberdyne system memory. So it's very lighthearted carbon freezer.
At the very bottom, it's all Star Wars planets. Bespin, Hoth. Carbon freezer is between Hoth and Bespin.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. You're right. Bespin and Hoth. Yep, click in my mind at first. Yep. So it's very clever. And so I actually got on the mailing list for this, and I have received the serial number 4.
I'll pause to say that I'm surprised that the Amiga didn't have a real time clock. That's news to me. Didn't it come out in 87 or something? How do they put a computer out in 87 that doesn't have a real time clock?
Amiga 1000 came out in, it was widely available in October 85, okay. And it had no real-time clock. That was a popular add-on. The Amiga 500, which came out in 87, did not have a real-time clock either. The Amiga 2000 did. It came out about the same time as the 500, and it was the slotted, you know, pro machine. But that was the first Amiga that had a battery-backed clock. Well, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is there was no battery. Like, you could set the time on the system. But it wouldn't maintain. There was no battery. There was no actual, you know, clock hardware except for the Amiga 2000. But that was a common piece added on with any accelerator that you added. So anyway, this has these pretty critical items. The storage, the way it works is it'll accept, I believe it goes up to 4 gigabytes if you're interested. It comes with a 2 gigabyte SD card. That is seen as a full 2 gigabyte volume. It's using a driver that is able to interact with the SD card as a FAT32 volume. So you're able to use it fully on the Amiga. You know, have all of the do everything you would on a normal Amiga desktop, and then pull out the card, come to a PC or Mac, and then just like drag Amiga apps into, you'll see the file system right there on the card. So there's no translation. You can mount the card as I've recently done. I renewed my purchase of Amiga Forever, which is the big, top end Amiga emulator. And you can mount the card as a drive, you know, in an emulated Amiga. And then you can actually take large, you know, installer files and have it install, you know, from the PC on that, and without having to have network running. Because you really, on an Amiga 1000, there is no real network option. I mean, there's a parallel port network option that I think will take you down the road you'd want to go, but it's not nearly as easy as connecting network hardware to, an Amiga 2000 or any of the other more recent Amigas. So I currently on my 1000, I have several sidecar expansions, which have a memory, real-time clock, SCSI controller, 2 hard drives, and I'm replacing this long sidecar of peripherals with this one little device, which is about the size of it's like a one of those thin one layer, you know, cigarette cases from the 60s or something. I don't know. It's very small with a 3D printed case. And interestingly, so the guy that designed it, David Dunkley, I've been going back and forth. I've been trying out different things with the device, and he's been sending me different versions of, some of the software with it, trying, you know, using it in conjunction with other peripherals. But the guy, and this came as quite a shock, he was the CIO. He's retired now from the Air Force. He was an Air Force commander. But he was the CIO of Space Force. Actually, Space Force, which I didn't think really had existed long enough to have anyone come and then go from it. But apparently that was, he had that post as the, I guess, the chief information officer for some time in the government, in addition to the being an Air Force commander. So it's interesting, interesting little tidbit there. But the device is currently, quote unquote, I don't know if that's actually at this moment or if it was, you know, when I ordered it a couple of weeks ago, there was a 20% off, $195, you know, if you reach out, basically an email request to get on the list. I think, I guess it's, you know, 20% more, you know, $240 or something is the final cost. So it's, you know, it's not the cheapest, it's not the very cheapest expansion, but if you have an Amiga 1000, it really gives you everything that you pretty much need. Again, there's not a network hardware in it, and networking is a big challenge for the Amiga 1000. But he, David actually, you know, has said he has some ideas, you know, down the road for, you know, there could be iterations that, that do more. Yeah, and so I should mention, I guess, the way that it works, because the Amiga 3000, the Amiga 1000 is incapable of auto booting. It's it you turn it on and it boots up its ROM from a disk, a kickstart disk, into a protected part of memory, and then once you do that, from then on, any warm boots, it just boots floppies as it needs to. That the version of ROM that's offered there does not allow the hard drive to actually the quote-unquote hard drive to actually boot without any floppy interaction. So what David provided is there's a technique that can be used where like the ROM boot disk and the workbench disk that you need to sort of bootstrap, you know, it kind of briefly boots up, transfers all the assigns, the directory assigns from the floppy over to the SD volume, so that basically you're loading the ROM, it pauses, it begins to load what, you know, is called the workbench, the Amiga DOS, you know, boot disk. And after just a few seconds of access, it has shifted control to the SD card. So, you know, it's not like click and you're booting off, you know, solid state storage, but it's as close as you can get on the Amiga 1000. And again, the Amiga 1000, it's not a practical machine if you're trying to get into the Amiga, but a lot of people consider it to be the most collectible and, you know, have great fondness for that particular Amiga, given that it was the first. So if you have a reason for, you know, using the Amiga 1000, which, you know, I it's my favorite Amiga, then, you know, this is quite a find. And yeah, so that's one of the nicest expansions. I don't know that I've ever seen an Amiga 1000 expansion that would even come close to this. I mean, nothing's been really specifically targeted for it other than, you know, over the years. And we'll have a link. A person kind of representative, an early tester of this is Eric Hill on Twitter. He's Amiga Love with a zero in the title there. He's has a similar configuration as myself, the Amiga 1000 with the same SCSI interface. And he's, he got one of these. I think he was the first person to get one outside of David's, you know, testing it himself. And he has a video demonstrating it with, you know, photographs and a blog write-up. So we'll put the link in there, and it shows the demonstration. But he also talks about some of the amazing Amiga 1000 expansions that existed, but they were, you know, years past. I mean, the Rejuvenator, the Phoenix board, these were transformative things for the 1000, extremely expensive. Unobtainium doesn't even really apply to the degree of difficulty involved in acquiring some of these things, not to mention the price aspect. But yeah, this is quite a, I mean, for, you know, $200-$240, it's not cheap, but it's sort of like kind of a no-brainer if you love and spend time with an Amiga 1000. So that's a very nice thing to have seen, to have come across.
My takeaway from that was that the Amiga has no clock and cannot boot itself. I don't know, it doesn't sound so great now. My 2GS can do both those things, just saying.
Yep. Let alone the 660 AV.
There you go.
That's right.
Well, I guess they, I think on the GS, what they did was they were able to fit the clock and the battery in because they didn't have to take that the blitter spot the place where that blitter
they had all that extra space because there was no horsepower
they had that extra space without the blitter and the copper some of those custom chips
all the place that would have been taken up by megahertz they used that for a clock
and the clock I think that might be battery. Also why the GS maxed out at 64K of sound RAM keep it just down to those two
make
chips
room for that clock
didn't want to
yeah.
take up too much for that clock
and in fairness to the Amiga, it was right on that cusp of where computers didn't yet have clocks like it, the GS did at that same time. But I remember at the time thinking, wow, like that was a crazy advanced thing that it had a clock at all. So, it's not too surprising that it didn't.
I mean, the GS came out like less than a year later and it had the clock. The Atari ST didn't have a clock. It didn't have a battery backup. I think, and I'm embarrassed. I'm almost positive that this is the case. I believe you can enter the time and it will maintain time like in some software capacity, but I may be wrong. Maybe it's just like the Apple II where you enter the time and it's frozen.
I think it does keep the time. So like if you boot into Workbench and you're doing stuff, like the timestamps on files you change will increment. Like time passes, but as soon as you turn it off.
Yeah.
It doesn't know what time it is.
Well, and that paradigm at the time was common. Like every time you boot DOS, it asks you to enter the time so that it can keep track of it for that session, but it doesn't have the actual battery. Yeah. So that would be in line with the period for sure.
Is there an XKCD about freaking out computers by typing in modern times? When you open up your old DOS computer, it's like, yes, what?
One thing I'll say is unlike, the hardware, I have this device, and it's the same thing that Eric Hill has, the Starboard 2. It's kind of a magic device, SCSI, FPU if you want it, expansion RAM, real-time clock. This was, popular hardware. So there's a number of those that people are using out there. It actually, it has the battery back clock, but the Starboard has the clock, but it won't take modern time. Like
it's incredulous.
It won't do the right thing. Its drivers, you give it 2021 and it's at, it seems to almost change how it interprets it. It's either 1921 or some crazy future date. But whatever the situation, well, there's custom software that David has put together here, and it does, it's giving it the actual year and time, which is nice in the file system.
Another I feel like that when people want to have really early business meetings with me, I'm like, wait, there's a 6:30 a.m. too? I don't believe you.
Yeah, I know. I know. I definitely sort of felt, back in those times, like the clock really felt like an add-on. Mm-hmm. Like you don't need this except under special circumstances, like running a VBS when it's going to turn off at a certain time or something. They're like, why do you even care? Just call this like version one, version two, version three.
Game developers want to make randomizers. They're desperate for different seeds.
It is. Interesting at that period of right on that cusp of 85. It wasn't yet clear that real-time clocks were valuable. Like now, it just seems now my freaking fridge has a clock. Everything's got a clock, but it wasn't yet clear that computers needed one. I think at least home computers.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy to think back on. If I don't, why would I care to need to know when that file was modified? Interestingly, it might be different with the GS, and I don't know if you were describing this exactly with what you said, Quinn. But as I recall, on the Apple IIc, like in ProDOS, you could enter the time, but it did not advance. Like it would stay frozen. Like whatever time you entered, that was what it was. And one of the pluses on, one of the devices we've talked about months ago that I have on my IIc is the Cricket Soundbox, which is it's like basically the hardware of a mockingboard at the end of a serial cable in such a way that it's incompatible with everything. But if you program it specifically, or you have music instruction set, the one program that supports it, it will play music. But it also has a clock that will keep, ticking. But it has no battery. So if you were to unplug it, it also will lose
time.
That's how
PCs were. Like it kept track of time. It just didn't save it between sessions. But the Apple II, of course, didn't because it had no way to count time. It had no interrupts or anything. So ProDOS had very lousy time and date support, but it did have just enough hooks that people could build real-time clock chips and things for it. But it was pretty crappy support.
Yeah.
Although ProDOS did come from SOS, and SOS did for the Apple III, and that did actually have a little bit more reliable clock stuff. But at least that was the intention. They took the clock out right before they shipped the thing. But
poor Apple III. She couldn't do anything quite right.
When you were talking about the Amiga not being able to boot, I was wondering if that actually sounds quite a lot like the Apple III in a way. Like, are the Amigas also just stranded if the floppy doesn't work? Then you just have a doorstop.
On the Amiga 1000, if you don't have if the floppy doesn't work, where you can load that 256K of ROM, you know, it's a firmware that sits, once it loads, it's protected, like nothing else can touch it until it's turned off. If you can't load that, you can't do anything with the device. Cool. Interesting that the Atari ST, the very first Atari 520 STs, were like this as well. They had nothing. They took it, but they very quickly, like within a couple of months, they finally finished their ROM and slapped it in, and then that was the end of that. So
interestingly, Apple went too hard the other way. Like the 2GS had the entire GUI in ROM, like all the APIs and SDK, the GUI SDK was all in ROM, and then that was terrible. And then the Macs had like most of the operating system in ROM, and that was terrible because it's of course immediately out of date. And so you've got this giant ROM sitting in your computer that has to be completely loaded from floppy off of into RAM anyway, because the one that's in your ROM is buggy and useless. we were still figuring these things out as a society.
It was early days.
How much ROM is the right amount of ROM?
There was on the Apple III. There's someone named Robert Justice who's been working on a drop-in ROM replacement that can actually boot off of some sort of compact flash card or something like that. It's something with a block driver.
How can somebody named Robert Justice not be out there fighting crime? What are you doing with your life, Bob?
Yeah, you should hope
granted that name. Go fight some crime.
Yeah.
Look, I'll go cause some crime and you come fight me.
He goes by Bob Justice, though.
Yes.
It's not as imposing sounding.
No.
The other thing that this reminded me a little bit of was the Mize and the M3SE for the TRS-80 computers. So, because they're similarly kind of like a super multifunction thing. Mm-hmm. The M3SE is for the Model 3 and 4 computers, and the Mize, the M1SE, is for the Model 1. But these also have Ethernet. They have solid state, you know, like compact flash cards. Mm-hmm. They have real time clock, video. They're pretty amazing, actually.
It's basically a better computer that you plug in.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the hardware that's, you know, doing, you know, whatever the embedded processor is on this thing is, you know, could run rings around the Amiga that it's controlling, obviously. I mean, in order to do some file backup, I was trying to move some files around from my old hard disk system to get them to the PC, to get them back on this so that I can then be in a place where it's like easy peasy to move forward. I was using a Raspberry Pi to, you know, serial bridge file transfers with like a terminal program on the Amiga, and then FTP them from the Raspberry Pi to the PC. And like, it occurred to me, this is the first Raspberry Pi. It's the oldest one I've got. I now have like five somehow, which it also came as a shock to me when I was thinking about it today. But like, the Raspberry Pi is, you know, what, orders of magnitude faster than the Amiga, even though it's pretty slow compared to other stuff. Yeah. So, you know, it's funny.
That is the funny part about all these devices. Like the Mize we were just looking at there, he had a picture of it on the screen there, and there's an FPGA on there, which is 200 million times more powerful than the Model 3, just to supply the Model 3 with a joystick port. Mm. That's pretty funny.
Yeah. Right.
Computing is infinite and free now, so we just throw it at every problem. Like, there's just no reason not to.
Yeah, I feel like I think of a new reason to stick a $15 Raspberry Pi, you know, wedge it somewhere and give it a purpose to solve a problem like every 2 or 3 months. It's funny. And again, you could actually, that would have been more powerful than any PC I had owned for decades.
I encountered that actually pretty directly when I was building Veronica, my homebrew APIC computer. Some of the problems, like, in, you know, I needed a keyboard, and so I was going to set up a PS2 keyboard interface, which is a little bit easier than USB. And it was going to be like 6 or 8 chips, or I could put a little Atmega microcontroller in there, implement PS2 keyboard and software, and it was one chip. And that little microcontroller is 100 times more powerful than the rest of the computer combined, but it's sitting in there just talking to the PS2 keyboard interface. But it was the easiest way to do it, and that microcontroller was a dollar. So, all right, just throw more power at it.
Yeah. It's I can't tell if these retro computers had, you know, like sentience and like feelings, if they'd feel like horribly honored or terribly insulted. I can't decide which
I've
side of it. You know,
to
I think
it'd
be a little bit of both. Yeah, it's like I'm talking to this thing. There's something attached to me that's 1,000 times more powerful than me, but that can't be.
Oh,
good.
It knows what
or,
it did.
You know. Oh, look what my owner is offering.
On the show.
Look at the power. Yeah. I don't know. It's funny, but yeah.
Well, this is like Marvin's problem, right? Like whatever, or the elevator.
Oh right, the talking guide. Elevator. Yeah. They have to make them stupid so that they enjoy their menial jobs. Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, okay, so that's all I got for that one.
Yep. Well, that's one item of interest that I'm down.
Welcome to hour two.
Good. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Okay. So,
yeah. Howard Scott Warshaw, who famously wrote for the Atari VCS both Adventure and the Indiana Jones game and the ill-fated E.T. game. Well-known figure, and he has a new book that's come out. It's called Once Upon Atari, How I Made History by Killing an Industry. I believe that is tongue-in-cheek. I don't believe that he actually killed the game industry by the release of E.T., as people sometimes say. But it's a great title. I've ordered this. It hasn't arrived yet. And,
didn't he do Yar's Revenge as well? Wasn't that him?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
Which is like
he likes to talk about how he made the best Atari 2600 game and the worst one.
Yeah.
I still don't understand Yar's Revenge.
Yeah, it takes... I think you have to... Like, if you just pick it up and try and play it, you won't understand it. You have to, like, I think it requires looking at the manual or having someone explain it to you a little bit, what you're supposed to do. But it's not complicated, but it is...
It's not obvious.
No, it's not obvious. It's a sequence of odd little things that you have to do one after the other. So, anyway, the book seems interesting. I will let you know after I read it, but just wanted to mention it here. There seems to also be a documentary called Once Upon Atari that also featured Howard Scott Warshaw from 2003. I just noticed that when I was searching for this book, but that I have not seen. It's on DVD, also on Amazon.
Yeah, I have that documentary. It's a little bit hard to find, but it is excellent. Really, really fun watch. If you're listening, Howard, hey. He's a good friend of mine, actually. I worked with him at 3DO, and we have been friends ever since. But the Once Upon Atari DVD set, he may still sell it on his website. He did for years, but he may have run out of the physical copies and doesn't sell it anymore. But if you can find it, really excellent watch. He's got interviews with all the original, developers from Atari and just sharing their stories of hot tubs and drugs and wrecking cars and just all the rest of it. The early Atari days were way crazier than you even think they might be.
Yep. So that's my item.
And let's see, I have sort of probably similarly short item. This just came to my attention. This may be of interest to only a subset of the people listening, but Nibble Magazine has like a renewed presence on the web. Mike Harvey, the founder of Nibble Magazine, had the previous presence on the web, but then he died. And it was kind of in limbo for a little while, but this is, I think, basically being run by Mike Harvey's family. So this is nibble-magazine.com. And it has a bunch of stuff on it. The main thing that you can get this way is a DVD that has a scanned bunch of all the issues. Nibble was a largely technical Apple II magazine. Like it's when you ask people about Apple II magazines, this is the one that everybody thinks about at first, maybe right after thinking about Softalk, and rarely anywhere near after thinking about A+. But anyway. So I just thought it was interesting because it had gone away and people had noticed it had gone away, and it didn't seem like there was a lot of fanfare about this coming back. But this is the official way to get Nibble scans. People have been they've been honoring the code pretty well and not posting scans of these around. So this is mainly the way you get them.
I'd also like to point out that if you click on Nibble merchandise, you can buy a Nibble bag. And as we all know, the best way to make friends.
That's right.
I can make some friends with a nipple tote bag. Someday I will have my bag friends, and then you'll all see.
I do also like that there's a nibble trucker cap. I feel like the audience for that might be zero, but I appreciate their optimism at offering it.
But it's cool. I'm glad that it's back. And it has, you know, it has a little bit of sort of background on it. It does look a little bit more modern than the original Nibble website did, which really looked like it was made in 1991.
You think they've got a mug that says Nibble on it? Mm-hmm. You should have a plate that says Nibble. Mugs should have like sip on them. Like it makes everybody look at that will say, "You don't understand how mugs work." Nibble is no. Put take cookie for Nibble, not tea.
I'm sad there's no Nibble beach towel.
That was it for me. Quinn, you have the
So I've been talking the last couple of episodes about how I've been wanting to possibly get into Amiga, and but the barrier to entry is very high, and I've been looking for some sort of book or something to assist in that. And so recently I decided to put my Google where my mouth is, and I actually went looking for such a resource to see if there actually is something. The closest I found was this. So it's pretty sad, actually. If you search for Amiga on Amazon, there's basically nothing, which is really sad because there's lots of retro computing books out there and tons of them on Amazon. But Amiga is like this wasteland book-wise. But there is one, and it's this one, Classic Amiga OS Programming. The tagline is that it's designed specifically for people who are very new to the Amiga and interested in programming it without knowing anything about the machine. So that sounds pretty close to what I'm looking for. So I did buy this and I will report back on it. I'll do my little what I did this summer book report on it after I get it. This book had many themes, I'm sure. I think this is a modern book. I think this is just based on the title, but I don't actually know what the copyright date on it is or if it's a reprint or what. But I think it's a book written in modern times. So this is sort of in the ballpark of what I was looking for, at least. But it's worth pointing out that over here on the suggested recommendations for this book is the exact type of thing that I'm looking for, except for the Commodore 128. So this is a 2019 retro computing user's guide for the Commodore 128. So the slights on the Amiga have never stopped. Even now, the Commodore 128 gets a retro user's guide. The Apple II, of course, has one. The Commodore 64, I'm sure, has 50. And the Amiga has none. So it's pretty surprising that this book exists, actually. But I'm glad that such books exist at all anyway. Still looking for that, kind of first-time user experience for the Amiga. So if anyone knows of anything, let me know. I did install the UAE Amiga emulator. I actually paid for the ROM and everything like you're supposed to. And played with it for a little bit, but was quickly lost. So we'll see how this book goes, if it's any good.
Cool.
Carrington is typing and not talking.
Am I supposed to be next? The Blake was next.
No, well, you're adding something.
No.
Oh, okay.
I just add to the notes and see whether you guys see it. Sometimes it's snarky, sometimes it's helpful. In this case, it's somewhat helpful. There's a book on Abbey Books called Action Amiga for $19. Looks like it's an old book. It's computer graphics and video production like on an Amiga, like an introduction to that kind of thing. So maybe like getting to know to use a computer first and then diving into programming, it can be a way to. So anyway, that's the only thing I could find on Abbey Books. So 8 billion books and they've got this one.
Honestly, this is going to sound stupid, but I didn't actually even think of that. Like look for old books from the time of like, you know, how do I use an Amiga? That actually didn't even occur to me to do that. So obviously that wouldn't cover SD card emulators and whatever, but it would at least introduce you to the basic concepts of the operating system and so on. How do you boot it? How do you copy files around? That sort of thing.
Because I figured there must be a contemporary book. I remember back in the day there was a MacBook called like the Macintosh is not a typewriter, which was basically like you bought a Mac, here's a thing to help you. So there must be an equivalent contemporary Amiga book. I just couldn't find it on Abbey Books, though. Not one for sale.
Probably. I had to poke around on archive. Maybe somebody scanned something from the time.
Hmm.
I know people, like, if you get into, if you're getting into development, even not necessarily even just assembly language development, but, you know, C or whatever on the Amiga, Commodore put out a series of books. They had the hardware reference manual. There was a library and devices, you know, book that listed, you know, the location numbers, what these things meant. It was like a three piece set of critical development texts, and the hardware reference manual is kind of a interesting thing. I read it as a casual relaxation read because it goes into the images, you know, the hardware, and it kind of maps out, you know, how the different internal you know, the blitters works and the copper, and, you know, how do you set up an octal these different frame buffers and set them in motion. I know Dave Dunkley, who built the device that I spoke about at length momentarily ago, he himself actually is using the first, has been using the first revision of this hardware reference manual to, you know, figure out all of the communications needed for the auto configuration protocol on the Amiga. And this is not this is a book that was at the time. It's certainly not a modern redo. So there's certainly value in looking back at some of the books that were, you know, critical back then, and they're still around. eBay, of course, that kind of thing. They might even be scanned and online, actually.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would like to find hard copies of these books if I can. Like the 2GS has something similar. They have this big library of official technical reference manuals, but they're all scanned, but they're really hard to read on the PDFs. Like you can't flip through the pages, and you can't, you know, they're often crappy scans. So yeah, it's nice to have the physical books.
Yeah, and it definitely is the case that scanning technology improves, you know, so it's like we don't want to have, I mean, I think of, not to badmouth the Nibble scans, but the Nibble scans are not all that great, you know, it would be nice to do those again. And yeah, I think I know what you mean, like the, what was it, the 2C+ reference manual, I think I remember.
Oh gosh, yeah, when I was doing hardcore 2C+ stuff, like getting into the ROM and doing hardware mods, the 2C+ schematic is a classic one. Like there is one scan of that document out there, and it is terrible. Like it is barely legible, and there's places where the fold is obscuring the exact information that you need, and but nobody seems to have an original copy of it to rescan it, and so we're all stuck with this terrible scan that someone did in whatever 2001 or something. And a lot of the Apple II books are like that. Like they were all scanned early, and so no one has rescanned them because there's a scan out there. But the early scans are all really bad. And like even like the ProDOS books and some of the other technical reference manuals, I have all of those on my iPad when I was doing 8-bit development. But they're really painful. Like you're scrolling through these giant PDFs that are image scanned and not OCR'd. And so they scroll really slow and you can't search anything and the table of contents doesn't work. And yeah, it's pretty awful.
It's funny. I'm looking now for what I'm about to describe, and I just found a clean and well done scan. So happily the there are alternatives, but when I was trying to disable the RAM on that Amiga expansion from days past, I was looking for the manual to, you know, online a scan to determine which jumper blocks, you know, to disable. And somebody clearly, like it must have been New Year's Eve, you know, like 11:40. Like they said, all right, I'm gonna scan this manual. Like they'd been drinking all day, you know. And it was just getting ready. They wanted to get it done in time to come give, you know, the wife a kiss. But this guy was like, we're going to get this thing scanned before this year is over. I'm not going to, you know, I've set this as a goal, and he scanned that thing. And I don't know, the pages were literally set at like 60 degree angles with a good 20% of the text gone off the bed. And they were going back and forth, like literally, you know, it was crazy. I was looking because I wanted to share it for the viewers at home, but I can't find it. I'm not going to spend the time while we're on the podcast. But yes, it's funny. I feel your pain. I saw enough though. I could see a picture of the jumper, like if I rotated my screen, and I could tell which way. So it worked out for me.
Excellent.
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. Actually, I think we can probably move on to the Atari VCS.
Okay, I guess this is mine, and this is not going to take forever. I think we can move through this one, despite appearances. So the Atari VCS, it is, I guess, back in GDC, the Game Developer Conference 2018, which was probably held in person, actually still in San Francisco. Atari, or quote, you know, whoever it is that is now Atari, called Atari, they had been working on this project and announced that they're bringing forth a new game console. It's called the Atari. They called it the same name as the original, the Atari VCS, video computer system, or maybe they're just keeping it at the initials, like that whole KFC back and forth. You may remember bygones. But it's a game console, and it looks like sort of what you might imagine if someone were to take an Atari VCS /2600 from way back in the 70s and, you know, make it look modern, but also harken back as far as its physical appearance. It's, you know, you have the option of wood grain on the front or glossy front. I think it's kind of an attractive looking unit. Anyway, so not a lot of information was available about the unit. Early on, you know, it was an Indiegogo only sponsored situation. So I don't know exactly how Indiegogo works as compared to Kickstarter or these other things, but I think they're similar. That's how you got in on it. They were developing not only the console, but a series of controllers. You know, one is sort of a more modern wireless current console looking controller. One is an adaptation of the, you know, classic simple Atari stick that has some LEDs on it. You know, so these are things that were coming, but there was not a lot of information. No one knew what it was going to be based on, what was the chipset, what were its capabilities. And then the lack of information was sort of, you know, it gave people pause as I was, you know, hearing people, you know, give their takes on this. It was a little shock for people to see that, to see this come out in such a way as not simply to be, oh, here's the, you know, NES Classic, or, you know, the Sega Genesis Classic, you know, which is just basically a small version with some, you know, games built in. This was more of a new console kind of thing with the retro throwback. So, but there was a demonstration, Jeff Minter, who had been right, you know, he's very, you know, famous in the Atari camp for years and years and years. Well, he's written a number of Tempest variations. Atari, you know, was the original Tempest publisher. He did Tempest 2000 on the Jaguar, Tempest 3000 on the Nuon, and then, you know, TXK, which was sort of a next generation. And he and Atari had a kind of a back and forth legalities on this and that. And then finally, it ended up with, you know, a situation where Minter came out with Tempest 4000 officially with Atari. You know, they cahooted, and so here comes, you know, Tempest 4000, which is an amazingly good game. I mean, it's a PC modern console. You know, go get it if you don't have it. It's great. So they show Tempest 4000 running on at some event, running on this console with video, and they showed, you know, sitting here, the guy was playing it. And so the presumption was that this was going to be, and I don't know if they actually, I can't recall if they actually, in anyone who knows, and Jack might remember this, like either they claimed that it was going to be a launch title, or that was the implication, you know, on this device.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly, but it was at least implied.
Yeah, it was certainly implied. And so, you know, moments later, days, you know, the next day, people were asking, they, you know, went up to Lavasov and said, hey, you know, Jeff Minter's company, what's the situation? Are you guys launching? And he's like, I've never heard of this console before. I have no idea what this console is about, what it might run on. Is it ARM or Intel? I haven't heard anything about this, so I don't know about being a launch title. He was, you know, baffled, and explained so colorfully, as he always does. And so, you know, time went on, and this was really causing people to wonder. I think, you know, in response to that, I remember commenting that, okay, this, I don't know, this seems like it's not going to happen, or it very iffy. Jack, I think you had your doubts.
Oh, yeah.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this a number of times over the past couple of years, always with a high degree of skepticism about the whole project. So,
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, so that happened. Time goes on, and then I guess the other day, I it was a few days, you know, out of the loop in the news cycle, but I see a YouTube guy, Spawnwave is his channel, and this guy is demonstrating the Atari. He had received the Atari VCS, and he unboxed it and took it through the paces, and so it actually arrived, and he himself was surprised. I think he, you know, it had been 2.5 years since he ordered it. He takes a good look at it. There are two videos. One is an unboxing initial look, and then the other one is he breaks it down physically and takes a look at the hardware inside and takes it through its paces. I guess a good way to kind of just explain, you know, what this is you know, talking about what it offers. So, you know, in the back of the box and on Atari's website, they claim, you know, it's a next generation game console. It has access to, you know, paraphrasing, access to a vault of hundreds of Atari games of old. And these are VCS games, Atari 2600 games. So basically you are, and it's demonstrated in this, the videos are quite good. I think anyone interested to just take a look, and that explains the whole thing. Either it's built in to the system. I think it's more of an online thing. I think the vault is basically you're kind of connected, but you get free access to these, as I understand it, if you are, you know, if you've bought the system. And apparently, the fellow who's doing the video, he said it costs $299 for him, $299. It looks like on Wikipedia there's a $199 version, a $299 version, and a $399 version. That $299 version that he purchased lacks controllers. There are no controllers with it, and clearly the $199 version is going to lack that as well. So you can, if you want to buy the premium controller, depending on the bundling, you can, you know, end up paying $400 for this thing. So, you know, the question is, what you get. It comes with it has a Chrome browser, like you can use it to browse the internet. It supports 4K. It has this vault, as they term it, of I don't know if it's almost all of the Atari VCS games. And there's a they term it something similar to, you know, PC mode, PC game. What it is it gives you the ability to boot off of a USB stick, Windows, Linux, some other operating system. And the way that this is possible is, and this was determined, you know, through a number of ways, and you can see it in the breakdown. Looking through, I've got, you know, amassed a few specs on this thing, and it's basically a small PC. It's a tiny Intel. You know, well, it's not Intel based; it's AMD based, but it's a X64 style PC for the price that I mentioned. It's based on a AMD R1606G Ryzen processor, which itself is, as far as the CPU core, basically a Ryzen 3 2000U mobile processor, which has 2 cores, 4 threads. It's a 2.6 gigahertz chip with 3.5 gigahertz boost. And it's on the APU. They've got a dedicated graphics chip. It's a laptop sort of graphics chip mobile. It's a AMD Radeon Vega 3 graphics core with 4 gigs of graphics RAM dedicated. The system itself comes with 4 or 8 gigs of DDR4 RAM. You can upgrade the system RAM. There's if you take it apart, they're just, you know, SODIMMs, that sort of thing. And there, it actually has a M.2 memory expansion micro connector inside, which lets you add super fast memory for storage. But apparently you can't boot operating systems off of it, which is unfortunate. The fellow in this second video here that we talked about, he actually goes into PC mode, runs Windows 10. He's bringing up emulators for the GameCube, for the Dreamcast, for, you know, I think the PS2, and he's seeing performance, and he takes you through some of the, yeah, playing through some of the games in there. There are parts, normally, you know, has pretty good frame rate, but there are parts where it, you know, it sort of lags in a bizarre way, as if it's sort of kind of a data, a IO sort of problem. And that's, I think that's due to the fact that it's, you know, pulling off of an SD card, and not, you know, not able to do on this M2 connector. And I guess there's hope that maybe with firmware changes you can get something booting off of there, but at any rate it's a PC, and if you want to do things other than play, you know, the Atari is at least right now in the vault, play the 2600 games, you need to do it using it as a PC with Windows 10 or whatever, and you know, Linux, whatever, and do it that way. So it's kind of strange. It's not, you know, I personally don't see a large appeal to this because, you know, there are other inexpensive PCs and some of them not necessarily, you know, x64 based. There's other options. It's kind of cool looking. You know, it seems like it doesn't exactly know what it is right now. I mean, it has a number of things, the browser, but it's a curious device. And I'm genuinely shocked that it actually arrived. I'm not going to be getting one, but I'm curious. I know some of you have been, you know, tracking this at least loosely. What are you thinking? Looking at what's presented here.
Like, what I'm thinking is if you had the guts two years ago to sign up on the what was it, not Kickstarter but the Indiegogo, whatever it was,
Indiegogo,
to pay $200 to get that, then it's not terrible. Like, for being a tiny PC with okay graphics and some interesting stuff for $200, but somehow when it gets to $300, which is what it costs now, still without controllers, I think it crosses the line towards, well, better to put that money towards an actual next generation gaming system instead, because for all the emulation it can do, I mean, you can do that on anything. You know, you can take your laptop you're probably using every day and hook that to a TV and run all those emulators as well or better than that thing will do, I'm guessing.
Yeah. I mean, for $399, you can buy a PS5.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, and if all it is now at the end of the day is a PC in a retro-styled case, like, well, okay. That's not great.
I'd rather just buy the retro-style case and stick my own little thing inside.
Yeah, if they sold the case, I bet a lot of people would buy it. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's just a PC. So it's emulating anyway. Well, so the experience is no better than a VCS.
Right. There's variants of operating system, even just for the ubiquitous, you know, Raspberry Pi. You get a Raspberry Pi 3 or 4 and you can download an image that is like, oh, here's the free ultimate Amiga emulation system. Oh, and here's, you know,
right,
emulate a PS. All these things I mentioned on this little device, you know, I don't see where the win is. You know, I don't see where the win is. And again, if you're going to get that controller, like, it might be more fun to, you know, spend $35 on a Pi and then buy that $400 PS5.
Right.
Yep. I don't know. It's curious. I've not been highly impressed by, you know, I guess what the term Atari is, you know, has been associated with over the past decade. And, you know, it's sort of sad, but, you know, things are happening, I guess. So that's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, on that point, we were talking about before the show, I think we're all universally shocked that this thing exists. Like, we all would have bet big money that this thing would never ship. Like, it had all the hallmarks of a stupid Kickstarter that's never going to happen. You know, every 2 years or whatever, they put out a render, you know, and it's like, oh, okay. So this thing's never going to be real. Like, you people don't know what you're doing. Clearly, you've never built a product before. But suddenly here it is. It's like, oh, well, okay. I mean, it's terrible and overpriced, but it exists. So that's something.
Yeah, I think it was even acknowledged in that demo where they, you know, were implying that, you know, Tempest 4000, like, they had Mentor was going to bring them this launch title. I think it was actually confirmed that, like, that was an empty case with a PC, you know, on the floor, you know, playing that.
It didn't even have actual
hardware.
I'll throw out a piece of advice for any future entrepreneurs designing products like this: stop naming your things that are ungoogleable. So, like, another recent one of these that came out was the full-size C64 emulator. It's got a real keyboard and everything, but it's called the 64 or the C64, one of those two,
right,
is the actual name of it. Completely ungoogleable. And same with this thing. It's called the Atari VCS. Like, how are you supposed to find this thing online? There's zero SEO, zero, like, that's just amateur hour as far as product naming. That baffles me that they do stuff like that.
Well, I think you can find it if you search for Atari VCS disappointing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Overpriced ATX cases.
Oh,
There it is.
Yeah, the cost stuff is going to kill him. You're right, because it essentially, I mean, it's great because it's got the official Atari brand, but it's essentially just emulating these things, and it's so cheap to get something else that will come with all the Atari games. Like if that's all you want, I've got a thing called a Super Console X, which is an ugly little thing. Easily Googleable though. If you Google Super Console X, you'll find this thing. Costs like $100, $120, and it comes with 50,000 games. It's like everything from Atari. It's just one of those here.
Right.
It does everything up to like basically Dreamcast. I mean, it's all of it. So if you like old, it's super. It comes with the worst controllers, but two USB plugs ports, and just says plug in whatever controllers you want. And I just got everything. And it's, so this is competing against stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like for $100, you get all the old consoles in an ugly case, but it works great.
Or if you're willing to put in a little bit of technical effort, a Pi Zero for $5 and Pi Mame will literally run every old console for $5. You still have to supply cables and power supply and figure out how to build a SD card boot and all that, but it's like $5.
Right.
But I know there's a lot of people, however, who even just, hey, download this disk image. That's too big a barrier to entry. Yeah. But you can get, here it is in a box, give me $100 and it's done.
Yeah.
And that's your highest end. And then this comes out and says, oh, I want $400, but it looks prettier and it plays less. That's going to kill it in the market.
Yeah, yeah. Products like the flashbacks and stuff make a ton of sense. Because, yeah, there's lots of people that just want to plug a thing into their TV and have a little nostalgia for 5 minutes and they're done. It's like, oh, I remember Pac-Man or whatever. But, yeah, those people aren't going to buy this thing.
Right.
Yeah. It's genuinely curious, and it doesn't. I don't see a lot. I could be missing it. I don't have one. But I'm not seeing a lot of like, you know, signposts in there being like, hey, this is where we are now. You know, the vault is going to expand. You know, like I'm not hearing that they're going to have Atari, you know, arcade stand-ups, you know, emulated on this.
Or if there was like an app store, like this open, it says you get all the Atari games, and we have an easy to develop app store to make new Atari games or whatever. Yeah.
Sure.
That could
I think that exists. So the videos that Blake mentioned before, I watched the first one, and he walked through some of that. There's like, you can go in there and you can buy some other games from their sort of app store. So like there is a thing like you can buy new games, newly developed, that are, you know, I don't know, not incredible looking, but like they are freshly developed modern games for this platform that cost. So you know, there were some that was one was $5, one was $20. There's some variation there.
That there is precedent.
So like there is an ecosystem of some sort there, but whether that will grow into anything useful is doubtful.
But that's the thing.
Yeah.
We have precedent for that idea too, right? Like there was the chip and the Pico 8, and like there have been all of these things that tried to be the new standard retro console. We're gonna put this thing out, everyone's gonna buy it, everyone's gonna make games for it, it's gonna be the new thing. And it never works. Like 50 companies have tried to create a new retro game development ecosystem, and nobody cares. Like,
But I mean, in a more difficult, when you look at it under, I guess, a more difficult light, sort of the competing store for this, given that it's a PC, would be like Steam.
Yeah.
You know, like you can have that whatever game they write for this thing, that person, I would assume, is or could sell it on Steam because this is just a PC.
Just like it was back in the day as this game developer. I'm like, well, what am I going to pour my thousands of hours of effort into platform wise so that the most people can see my game? If I'm going to develop a new retro game right now, I'm going to go target Vice, a Commodore 64 emulator, something like that, because I can bottle my game with Vice, you know, like Nox Archaeus did. I can bottle it with an emulator. Millions of people can run it with one click. I'm not going to target this thing that like 500 people are going to buy anyway. And at the end of the day, it's a PC anyway.
Well, I hear, Quinn, that they were originally going to name it the VCSO, you know, to through, you know, the stereo.
Yeah.
VCSO. So it was going to be your VCS go-to.
Atari-O.
Listeners will have to reference our last
callback
to understand that joke.
That one's for the fans.
All right. So in the end, what we concluded is that this is actually not a topic for a retro podcast.
Yes.
Like, we spent an hour on it.
Let's never speak of this again.
It's good that we've addressed it, but yes, we need not return to it.
Very cool. Okay. Let's see, we can maybe move on. Jack, you have... No. Carrington, you have the next thing.
Me? Carrington, it's me. Welcome to the show. It's me. I have an article that's very bad and wrong, and I am wrong about that and have no right to say it's bad and wrong. So I have a very interesting relationship with this article. I'm going to share that with you guys because it's like a roller coaster reading this thing. So first of all, it's on a site called Debugger. You get like three views or something of members-only stories. So this can be one of your free members-only stories. And it's about the Atari and then Activision, Absolute, and other computer game companies from the early 80s and late 70s that all started with A. And the premise here is they all started with A because if you were going to appear at E3, the Electronic Entertainment Expo used to exist, or CES or whatever, then people would show up, they would know Atari, you'd open up the big book of where everybody's booth were, and so they might not go past Atari once they found that. So you got to name yourself so that you appear above Atari, otherwise no one would find you. Now, on the face of it, that seems like nonsense, because if you think of all the computer, like Commodore, Tandy, Radio Shack, Intellivision, ColecoVision, like they all don't start with A. Like it's crazy to think, like, or even just if it focuses on software. I looked up companies, like video game companies established in 1979. The only A is Activision. The rest are Sierra and Capcom and Eduware and Infocom and SSI. And like, and 1980 is the exact same thing. So this seems like on the face of it, completely wrong. But that said, it's a very interesting read because it talks about how Activision gets spun off. And that's a pretty famous story, but it's written up here really neatly because it talks about how in 1980 or so, or late 1979, Atari tries to get everybody motivated to focus on the games that are going to sell the best. But as it turns out, as the article says, showing some people who are making annual salaries of $20,000 that their games have collectively generated $60 million probably doesn't go over very well. And then when they ask for a raise, I guess Atari tells them, you're no more important than the people on the assembly line that screw the cartridges together. You're just cogs in the wheel. And thus Activision gets born as those people go, screw you, we'll make our own company. And so this talks about how then you Activision gets named with an A because they want to be right above Atari. And then the same thing happens next with Accolade. And I'm thinking, this is wrong. This is all nonsense. And then I realized this article is written by Gary Kitchen. Mm-hmm. And Gary Kitchen certainly knows more about this than I do. He was like one of the founders of Accolade. And it's Gary Kitchen. So he's there at the time and knows a lot more than I do. But at the same time, this seems like a completely wrong fluff piece. So I have difficulty reconciling those. So clearly, the person who wrote this article knows more than I do, was there at the time, and should know all about this. But the facts don't seem to be in line with what this article saying, because the vast majority of companies in this industry that started at that time do not start with A. So make of it with what you will, but it's an interesting article that I was very dubious about until I saw the byline.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it could be that there are that those two companies, Activision and Accolade, and maybe Acclaim, I'm looking at those chairs scrolling, maybe those are the ones who thought of it. You know, right? Just like we talked about, you know, Quinn mentioned naming the Atari VCS, the new one, the same thing, is terrible for SEO. Like they didn't think well of their, they didn't think about their product name very well, but maybe some companies did. And like, yeah, we want to name our thing to be right before the big company that people.
But the idea that by the time like Acclaim or Absolute come around and we're getting to the late 1980, early 1981, the idea that those people think the only way someone will find you if you start with A, because they've never heard of, for instance, Broderbund or Datasoft or Learning Company or Sirius or WizardWorks or DBSoft. Like there's like a ton of companies now that are formed by 1980, right. None of which, almost none of them start with A. So it doesn't seem to make sense, but it's written by Gary Kitchen. So,
yeah, I mean, like, it still can be a thing where, yeah, it doesn't make sense in a sense, but like it can be that like if you think of it, and you're that guy at Accolade who thought of this. Like, wait, I see Atari and Liz, the Activision. Wait, we can get one step ahead of them. Like, it may feel like it's a genius idea. It may not have actually made any difference to anybody in the world. Like,
and certainly historically, this was a thing people used to do. That's why you would get AAAAAAA towing company or whatever.
Right. For so the phone book.
Like how people name stuff back then. But none of them named their software like Aardvark software, which would be the obvious one. But
yeah. Anyway, my hypothesis on this is that this is, it's not as much of a thing as people now say it was, first of all. Like, this is, and it is something that the founders of all those companies say, oh, yeah, we named it Acclaim because of this, we named it Accolade because of this. But I think that's a lot of retconning, maybe, of how important that really was to the decisions. Because if you look at the old interviews from, you know, years past, the reasons for why they did it change, right? Some will say it's the E3 listing. Others will say it was because of the phone book. Others will say it was, you know, listings of companies in advertiser indexes and magazines. So there's the reasons keep changing. And as you say, Carrington, the story doesn't sound right unless you list these six companies that are all formed 15 years, spanning 15 years, which doesn't make any sense. And the whole story is just is a little too on the nose. Like, it's a little too enjoyable, I think, because people keep retelling it. So I kind of think that they just liked these names, and it was kind of a running joke amongst all these, you know, friends who were CEOs of these companies, and they all kind of were having a little fun with it. But I don't think it was, you know, a legit ongoing war to see who could get smaller in the alphabet.
Although it could be, I mean, it's you know, a little bit like why swimmers shave themselves or whatever, right? You know, just like a little bit of it, little help, you know.
Yeah,
they do that, right?
Yeah, when all of this stuff has happened so long ago, right, that everyone's memories about it have changed, and who knows what why these decisions were really made at the time.
But it undercut my ability to come in and say, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, when I saw who the person was.
It's good to respect, the author of that post. But at the same time, like, even the people that were there, we change our own memories to fit a story that we like, right? So he may remember it as being, that's why they did it. But who knows if that's really why they, at the time.
Right. And I think that, like, the current theory of, like, brain science is that we change our memories just by thinking
about
things. Absolutely.
Yeah, every time you recall a memory, you change it a little bit.
Yeah.
You make the story a little better to yourself every time. And we don't even realize we're doing
our
that.
Our brains run on magnetic media.
I'm increasingly the hero of this story.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's how I remember it.
Well, and that story about the naming, the alphabetizing names, is so commonly told in gaming and retro circles. Like, everybody loves that story, right? And we've told it on this show 1,000 times. So a story that's that widely told, it just becomes part of the cultural zeitgeist, and even the people that were there remember it that way, even if that's not really what happened.
Yeah.
Okay. One last thing, I think. Is that it? Yeah. I'll put this up. I challenge us not to talk long about it, but we'll see. This has been sort of like making the rounds a little bit recently, because we our hobby got a mention in the New York Times, and you'll note retro computing is spelled with no space in the middle. It's all one word. But so there's this article called "The Impractical but Indisputable Rise of Retro Computing," and it's kind of cool. It largely, you know, it's basically kind of marveling at the price that people are willing to pay for these things, and talking a little bit, I guess, about why people might get into this, that it is kind of like a link to the past and that sort of thing. So, I mean, it's better than some of these articles have been, but it still is kind of marveling at the price, which I worry about a little bit, because that's just going to mean that, you know, with this public discussion of high prices will come further high prices.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it's kind of neat. Anyway, there's a, you know, picture of an Atari ST in a modern New York Times.
And yep, the prices on everything just doubled. Cool. Great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yet we still spell retro computing roundtable as retro space computing.
That's right.
Yeah, I was kind of bummed when I read this that they didn't give a shout out to our podcast.
Indeed. Right.
They couldn't find it because they Googled for retro computing. That's one word. We didn't show up.
But there are, in the comments, there are people we know too. So I know that Blake, for example, was in the comments, and I think there were other people that we know in here too. So it's,
and someone we don't know, they mentioned Snoop Dogg.
Oh, Snoop Dogg
in the comments. Yeah. And a couple of people.
Sure, Snoop Dogg's
inside.
In the comments. If it's actually Snoop Dogg or not, but
yeah,
it was someone calling himself Snoop Dogg
actually
talking about the good old days using the Amiga and the video toaster.
First of all, you don't know that I don't know Snoop Dogg.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Also worth noting that the Atari ST gets a mention and the Amiga does not.
Of course.
Still
of course.
Getting slighted.
Sad. Sad.
Yes.
Well, they showed an Amiga.
Yeah,
they
actually don't
an
know.
There's an Amiga 500 picture.
I haven't read the article.
Uh-huh. Although, they showed that really, really weird Atari ST. If you look closely at the Atari ST picture, it's that strange monitor. It's an RGB monitor that has a floppy disk.
Oh, yeah, I saw that too.
And that's it.
What is that?
That's not the computer. That's a monitor with a floppy drive in it.
Yeah, what the heck is that? I saw it. It didn't. No. I was like, what the heck is that?
Yeah, yeah. The computer itself is in the foreground. It's an Atari 520 STM. That's the type of. That's exactly the Atari ST I've got over here on the desk. But the monitor, they had a variation of a monitor where it's like, okay, here's a monitor, and we're going to give it a full width base and put a floppy disk in it, drive, and then there you go. You got your floppy drive.
Did that
drive.
Exist? That monitor? Yeah. I've never seen that before.
Yeah, yeah. I it's very rare. I've seen it. It's not early on in the life of the Atari, particularly, okay. But I don't think. But I've seen it a few times. But it just seems such a bizarre thing.
Right.
That image looks like it was taken from like a press photo from back at the time from Atari or something. So it was probably a prototype or from a trade show or something.
I feel like it was released. Obviously, it existed at least in a prototype. But it just always seems so strange to me.
Yeah.
Just a monitor with a. With the floppy drive.
I mean,
you got to get sort of really close to the magnetic, source.
Yeah. In fact, the caption says in 1985, so that is a period photo. It's interesting that they would choose a period photo instead of actually taking a retro computing photo, like a modern person using these machines, as the article is, talking about. It's sort of strange that they would use a period photo instead, but it's probably a case of that's what they had in their archive or whatever, and they didn't have to pay for the photo that way.
I think if they had Googled, Atari ST, they would have gotten some really good pictures in the first few links. That I'm sure they might have been happy they linked.
Yeah, but then they got to run down the ownership of the photo, and they got to pay somebody for it, and there's paperwork. It's like I'm sure they, like I said, they pulled this out of their archives because they had it and it was free.
Mm. Oh, well, Blake's name's right there.
It says it's from Getty Images, so maybe they searched on Getty and that's what came up.
Yeah, could be.
That's why some of us use Creative Commons 2.0 attribution license so people can use it, and you can go watch where your images end up for fun. I like that. That's fun. Anyway.
Okay.
I didn't mean to get salty about the New York Times.
I got you all riled up with my Amiga slights.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. Let's see. So, Michael showed up in the.
I can see Michael is in the comments, and so we don't hurry on and get moving. He's going to come in and restart this show.
That's right. So there's one thing left to do here before we get to the word from our sponsor, which is the WASFest 18. So this is we've transitioned into the upcoming show roundup section of the show, and there's only one show that I have made any notes about, which is WASFest 18. So this is basically Saturday, March 20th, Sydney time at noon. So if you are interested in that, go. It will be streamed, right? Yeah, streamed on Twitch. So this is accessible even if you are not in Sydney. Because I think it is usually actually a very small event. So, but you can make it much larger on Twitch. Michael says he'll be there. So that's cool. Enticement or a threat.
Take it as you will.
Okay. I think that's good. And now, a word from our sponsor.
If all the arguments about which home computer to buy have you confused, meet the convincer, the new Atari 1200 XL. It has a 64K memory, like the Apple IIe, but for about $400 less. Sorry, Apple. Over five times more software than the Commodore 64. You're outranked this time, Commodore. The Atari 1200 XL offers three more sound channels and 240 more colors than IBM's personal computer. Guess home computers just aren't your business, IBM. Texas Instruments. Like them, you don't have on-screen self-testing or a help key. Take your hat off, Texas Instruments. The powerful new Atari 1200 XL home computer. The convincer.
Atari, the official computer of the Association of Tennis Professionals.
And we're back. So the next thing to talk about here is the host's retro computing gift idea. And the host of this retro computing gift idea is Jack.
Yeah, so this popped up somewhere. It's an interesting looking gamepad for Atari and compatible Amiga, Atari ST, what have you, systems. Good price. The reviews I've seen seem mostly pretty good. So it's both a joystick and a paddle controller. So it's hard to see in the picture, but on the left is a single rotatable paddle.
Mm-hmm. It's called a Hyperkin Ranger Premium Wired Gamepad.
Yes, thank you. I should have said that initially. The Hyperkin Premium Wired Gamepad. So it's also mentioned that it is for the Retron 77, which Hyperkin also sells. Which some kind of
people console. Don't know they do a lot of consoles that play old things like the Retron 3 and stuff, and so they'll play NES games or NES games and Super NES and Super Famicom games. They put the actual cartridges in and they'll play them. They're kind of mostly known for making those.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Cool.
Yep. And so this controller seems pretty good. I haven't bought one, but I've been thinking about it. I guess the one downside with this thing of having an integrated paddle is that normally on the Ataris, you had two paddle controllers you plugged into one port, and this occupies one port with one paddle controller, which means you probably can't play any two-player paddle games with this. Like Pong expects both the two paddles to be on the same controller port, mm-hmm. right? So, but a one-player paddle game should work fine. And I think it's kind of neat to have both a paddle controller and a joystick in one. That's pretty unusual.
And it looks nice. So, I mean, I think it's supposed to be nice. Ergonomically well-designed as well.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting design. It's very different from most other designs, but it does have, looks like it has a modern sort of D-pad-ish joystick rather than like a big joystick. It's not exactly a D-pad, but it's something in between. And it can be yours for $24.99, I should mention. That's U.S. dollars.
Yeah, which is not much.
No, it's a really good, it's a quite reasonable price for almost anything like this.
Yeah. Well, and actually also the, I think this same controller can be used for like a Commodore 64 too, right? And I mean, like there's a number of things that use the same kind of standard.
Yeah. Anything that uses this, like the standard 70s, 80s, 9-pin DIN, digital joystick interface that Atari popularized would work.
Well, we should mention though, I guess it's worth mentioning that the Retron N77 is Hyperkin's Atari console version of their thing. So it would be going essentially head to head with a new Atari VCS because the Retron 77 takes an SD card that you can throw ROMs on, although it's weirdly limited in the number of ROMs you can have on a given card. They did this weird slot thing that everyone's complaining about, but can essentially play all, you download the ROMs, you can play all the Atari games, and it also has a cartridge slot, so you can play official ones as well. And it's, I think, $70. So again, the problem with the ungoogleable Atari VCS is it's up against other things that do this basically the same thing and more for $70.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Anyway, buy that for yourself, buy it for a loved one,
and then
buy it for me.
Buy it for Paul.
Just buy it for, but just buy it.
Yeah. Yeah, not expensive. Mm-hmm. And when you're done just buying that for yourself or for a loved one, you can turn to eBay and buy what Blake tells you to buy, which is the following.
Okay, so I've got a couple of, I've got three items that I'll move through quickly. The first of which is a Macintosh 2 RISC 88000 processor board for the Macintosh 2, again, estate sale item. Now, apparently this is a Tektronix board. It looks as if it has four 88000 processors, but I'm not sure exactly what's going on with it. It has a new bus connector and some RAM and empty RAM expansions for the board itself. The 88000 was a RISC processor that Motorola was trying to bring forth to compete with Spark and MIPS processors, you know, Sun and SGI. They had some iterations of it in the late 80s. I know several companies were looking at it as a potential next step. They were using, you know, 68,000, 68030s, Apple, Apollo, Next, all were evaluating. I think there was a prototype Next that used the 88,000. But by the time, I guess what was considered, as I understand it, you know, the most practical device, 88110, was available in 1990, people had moved on and it sort of didn't happen. And then PowerPC is where Apple went and that sort of thing. So anyway, this is a board that you plug into a Mac 2 and basically you can use it to code for it in C and Fortran. So this is a higher performance processor, I think, by far than what's in the Mac host. And you can have it execute programs, you know, faster on this board, and they can actually run simultaneously with the 68020 code, you know, that's running on the Mac 2. 20 megahertz board, it'll accept, well, I guess it comes with 8 megs of memory, and apparently the cost was $12,000 back in the day. So it's, yeah, that's a lot of money, but I guess it was a very, I mean, the Mac 2 itself was very expensive, and this is a lot more power, you know, than the Mac 2. It's a buy it now for $3,705. Free shipping. So if you want to really hit some Fortran and other language code, you can do that with this device. So I thought it was interesting. Anyone have any old tales about the 88,000?
Nope.
Nope, but it's interesting in the description how, which is, this is clearly taken from a write-up at the time, that number, like that it cost $12,000 to get this thing. So the total cost for a Mac would end up being $19,000, $12,000 for this thing, $2,000 for this Fortran compiler, and then $5,000 for the original Mac you put it in. So it says that the table indicates it runs 2.4 times slower than an IBM 3090, which is a supercomputer, but at 260 times less cost. So you can see how, well, this seems outrageously expensive to stick $14,000 worth of stuff inside a $5,000 computer if you're going to be hundreds of times less expensive than the supercomputer you're competing against. And maybe the math worked at the time.
Sure. Yeah, I'm sure this was a NASA, you know, other laboratories. I'm sure this is the kind of thing, clearly very niche uses, you know, but I'm sure these weren't like, you know, hotcakes.
Well, like Quinn said, it's like, let's put a better computer inside this computer.
Yeah, it's an early example, right? All right, except it's not just sending a stream of serial data across cable, I guess. Anyway, I thought that was interesting. You don't see the 88,000 very often. Okay, so the next item I have is the Exatron. We've talked about the Exatron stringy floppy drive. It's actually a tape system with a continuous loop, sort of akin to the 8-track tape, continuous loop.
I love these.
There was a number of these drives, third party, available for, I think, Tandy Model 1, you know, Model 3. I think some of the European machines used it. There were variations of the stringy floppy. I think the wafer tape drive TI was going to use with the, you know, the CC40 and their hex bus interface. And I think there were some other, you know, takes, but this Exatron stringy floppy actually got used, you know, in a number of areas. I've seen, you know, Model Tandy Model 1s with two of these and software on it, you know, going. Anyway, clearly they're not making more, you know, stringy floppy wafer tapes, but this is a lot of 40. So if you have a stringy floppy drive that uses the Exatron tapes, and there are people out there that do and are probably using them with remote frequency, here are 40 of these. They have data on them. They're not new. Clearly, it's $299, buy it now. 40 of them used. Some have scratches, contain various programs. Some tapes are unwound. That can't be good. Some have cracks. So yeah, sold as pictured. But anyway, yeah, I thought that was, if you're a mate, you know, there's gotta be some of us out there where like their whole scene is based around stringy floppies, you know, that's like it. And, so here's what you need to continue.
That's the most stringy floppies that have ever existed in one place.
Yeah, because ain't nobody going to be making any more of these. Yeah. You know, so you gotta, yeah, you grab them while you can.
Plus, it's so fun to say stringy floppy.
Yeah. The Sinclair QL also used tape loop, and I think that might be the most mainstream source or use of that technology aside from 8-tracks, because those machines did fairly well.
Right, I know it. It had the built-in. Do you know, is it actually of this Exatron format?
No, or is it it's their own design. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, it had that. That was the coolest thing. The little built-in. Yeah, I love that. But cooler in concept than in usage.
Yeah,
I
don't think they worked very well, but yeah, they were neat.
Yeah, stringy floppy. You can call them tapes, but if you do, you have to hold your pinky out when you do, because it's a fancy tape.
Yeah, well, and Sinclair went out of their way to hide the fact that it was a tape loop. Like they had some marketing name for it, and they called it like better than floppies, and they called it a data storage system. Like they never used the word tape because that had a low brow connotation.
Sure.
I think
Well, no, people, the specky users, tired of, you know, slow tape loading.
Somebody used the word wafer for this, I think.
I think that might have been what Sinclair called theirs, was wafer, yeah.
And I know, no, I believe the TI also used wafer.
Robotronics one? Something like that. Was the wafer drive, wasn't it? That was the, I thought the,
I feel like.
Maybe I might be confusing those.
I feel like they might have used the Exatron media. The Tandy Robotronic drive.
Also, just a little bit of trivia. I was looking at this and thinking, you know, we've talked about these before. So if you go back and listen to episode 214 on May 17th, you will also hear us discussing this auction.
This auction?
Oh, awesome. They have not sold all year. They have not sold.
Wow.
Whose item was it? Please don't say mine.
Well, it's under your name.
Wow,
that's got to be a bingo square.
But I don't know for sure. Wow. Actually, though, if you brought it up, it's possible that it was added in discussion. But because I remember looking at some of these and trying to figure out whether the tape held 16K or whether the computer had to have 16K or.
Yeah, maybe we should edit this.
No way! This is my favorite part of the show so far. Oh, I should point out in the comments, Spectron, aptly named Spectron, points out that the ZX Spectrum one was called the MicroDrive.
Yes, okay.
Yes, which I just looked that up so that I could say it. But thank you both for stealing my thunder. But yes.
Your thunder is ours.
Yeah. And I'm glad actually that we brought that up, because what's cool about, or what I like about that name, MicroDrive, is that not only did they go out of their way to not call it a tape, they tried to make it sound like a floppy-like device.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that you would think it was hip and modern, but in fact it was an 8-track. And it was terrible, and it was garbage.
Yeah. And
nothing is more hip than Adams.
Coleco used a straight-up mini micro cassette or mini cassette and called it a digital data player. You know,
wow.
Like I think it was basic. I think it was not quite, but basically, it was a regular, you know, cassette.
That's
tape.
Marketing spin.
It wasn't a loop. It wasn't in a loop or anything. You know. Anyway, so there you go. Again. I will cautiously move to my next item. If anyone
does not look familiar,
I remember this.
Said this before. Someone raised their hand. So, what this is? I know we've talked about the computer that these are connected with. It's, anyway, I'll read the title. It's Vintage Dimension 68000 Computer System 5 1/4 inch floppy disk with sleeve, 5 disks. Yeah, we talked not that long ago, probably since May, about the Dimension 68000, which was the 68000 MC68000 based system that it did its own thing, but it also accepted interface cards for emulating other systems. I know the Apple II was one, PC, CPM, and I feel like there might have been a Commodore 64 card. Anyway, this is of interest because if you look at it, not so much in the same way as the stringy floppies, you know, random, you know, use for new data, but these are, you know, system utility disks, system utility disk 4, 3, 2, 1, emulation disk, released 1.21, June 1984, copyright digital research. Okay, wonder what that's emulating. That's CPM right there, surely. Well, actually, they all say digital research. Interesting. I don't know if digital wrote all of the OS. I mean, maybe this is all to do with the CPM side of things. But at any rate, I would be very curious as to whether or not these are archived. And so I point these out. I mean, of course, if you have a 68000, you don't have this software, that's great. But this seems like a good one. Like getting these archived would be a great thing. Unfortunately, it's, you know, $200 for this item. It's a buy it now. And it's located in Tyler, Texas, and there's a very lengthy list of places where it can be shipped, but I assume it's not every country in the world. But anyway, this looks like a good archive opportunity. I'm guessing there aren't huge online archives of Dimension software, but that caught my eye, and I've always been keen on the bizarre Dimension system. So there it is. That's the last one that I have to bring up.
Excellent.
So.
Cool. Carrington, you have the next thing.
Okay. So as you guys know, I like a theme, and generally I'm trying to sell stuff to Paul, but we're doing a twist this time. These are a couple of things that Paul should not buy, and no listener should buy. So pick some auction items nobody should buy. The first is this keyboard keycap remover. So it's a little ring, little two sticky outy bits. and it says works on an Apple II, which is why it's selling for $999. Doesn't sound like a lot, but this is a general thing sold all the time on eBay for a buck when it doesn't say Apple II in the listing. So if you get out of the vintage section and just look for keycap removers, this is a little tiny piece of plastic. So often you'll see, how can this little piece of plastic be $10? Well, it's because they can buy it for $1 and sell it to you, Apple II schmoes, for $10. So it's neat. And if you do want to remove keycaps, this kind of thing and variants of it work quite well. It's like a little ring, stick it on your finger, you push down on the keyboard, you pull up, out pops the keycap, which you can do without one of these as well. But the nice thing about these keycap removers is it pulls from two places, and so you're less likely to snap the little plastic underneath them. So they work well, but don't spend $10 on it. Spend $1 on it on eBay. So that's my first choice, is to say, here's a neat thing. It says Apple II. Ignore that part. Look elsewhere. So Paul, don't buy this.
Yeah. One thing I should also say, though, I mean, like, one thing that works really well for the removing keycaps are chip pullers. They're terrible, terrible things for pulling chips, but they're great for keycaps. Yep.
That's what I use while I use my chip puller.
It's a good idea.
I never thought about that before. Nice. See, you can get one for nothing. Yep. Paul, don't buy this. Buy that instead. The next thing I want to not sell you is the ugliest joystick I've ever seen in my life. Brace yourselves. Here you go. It is the hobby stick.
What?
And it's a monster. I love this thing. Paul, don't buy it, though. It's ugly. Now, there's a couple of these on eBay at the moment. This one is $70. Buy it now. And it's still new and sealed. You can spend $80 to buy one on eBay that's been opened and used. So that's how this thing rolls right now. It's cheaper to buy a new one. Hobby stick is in quotes. Like, it's like the hobby. Like, it's got scare quotes around the name. It's kind of a handmade sort of thing. Like, I love it. It's got these three switches on them, kind of like the top Atari VCS, but they have little hand-cut piece tube plastic over top of them. Mm. It's got multiple buttons. I love this thing. I don't understand this thing, but it's joystick. And it's the ugliest joystick I've ever seen.
It's amazing. So it's configurable. Like you can choose whether left is left or left is right, and up is up or up is down. And they have the two buttons absurdly close to each other. But
so you can flip the axes basically with a switch.
Yeah, that's the concise way to say what I said.
Everything about it is delightful. But the buttons are small, sticky, uppy buttons that would hurt your finger.
Yeah.
Everything about it is an ergonomic nightmare. I adore it. Paul should not buy it.
Yeah, I don't think this is a computer gaming joystick. I think this is targeted at, like, electronics enthusiasts or RC people who, like,
you... Flight simulator.
Yeah. Well, no, like, you're controlling your remote control airplane or an RC car, or you want to have a joystick control on your electronics project. I think that's maybe what this is.
Oh, why did...
Is it made out of the material that an egg carton is made of?
Hopefully so it'll muffle sound.
Maybe. The nice thing about this one was $10 because it was filed under retro computing. So that's why you paid $10 instead of $1. This one has been uploaded to eBay in the vintage manuals and merchandise section of vintage computing to make it hard to find. Right. You gotta really want a hobby stick. Hobby, by the way, is spelled HOBBI. Everything about this just tickles me.
Those buttons are off-the-shelf Radio Shack parts from that era. I actually have a bunch of those in my bin from back then. Like, that was, if you went to Radio Shack to buy a push button, it was those exact ones.
Nice.
So I think this must have been like a hobbyist who would made this product to sell to other hobbyists, and he was sourcing the parts from like Radio Shack and elsewhere.
Yeah.
I like how because you've got your hands so tightly clustered around those next virtually unseparated buttons, they've extended the height of the toggles with the plastic tubing so you can throw those switches a little bit easier. Interesting.
And the seller says,
I kind of want this, actually.
Yeah, the seller says on the bottom, you see in this photo here, appears to be documentation bundled in it. But they'll know because it's sealed. So there appears to be here a little piece of paper or something tucked in the shrink wrap. So it comes with documentation, but we don't know what that is.
What secrets might it hold?
And there's no photo of the back. So what it attaches to, don't know. Because there's no cable coming out of it.
Is there a cable?
Is there? Does it have no case?
Well, it says it's for Apple II and Apple III, so it's, this seems to be.
Maybe it's under it.
Maybe it's wrapped up inside there. This device doesn't even have like a bottom plate, and the whole cable is just shoved up inside of it.
Yeah,
maybe.
One can hope
with the instructions, like a fortune.
And
cookie.
I can't tell by looking at the stick itself, but I like to think that stick does not actually tilt, but slides in both axes, because that would be sweet. Mm.
That would be sweet.
That would be.
Okay, so a quick update. Since, as I said, this is available. If you want to spend more, you can get it used. This is the listing from somebody else, different seller, for $80, not shrink-wrapped. And I bring this one up because it includes photos of the back of it. So I don't know if you guys want to guess now what kind of port it has, what kind of cable it comes with. But whatever you guess, you're wrong. The back is completely empty.
Yeah.
Okay, Quinn, explain that one.
I think on the underside,
there are no cables. The bottom.
What about the bottom?
The bottom is sealed.
Oh, the bottom.
This is a completely sealed box.
So I think you're probably supposed to take the bottom off, and on the inside there's terminals because you're supposed to wire it into your project. Like
I think it's
home.
An Apple III wireless joystick, and now, Paul, you should buy it.
I hope so.
Yeah. But like if you were, you know, if you're playing around with robotics and that kind of thing, like you want to build a hero robot like thing or whatever, like this kind of thing would be useful for that. So that's my guess about what it is.
I guess there's enough clearance under the bottom, at the edge of the bottom panel, that a ribbon cable could be slipped out. Just barely.
Yeah, probably.
Maybe. Or the intent is you're supposed to cut a hole for whatever wiring you want for your project. Mm. Something like that. Like that, you know, it's sort of like a project box in that sense.
Anyway, Paul, I picked this, and you should not buy it. Yeah. I'm giving you a couple weeks off from buying the things I recommend.
Mm-hmm. I did. By the way, did I tell you that I did get the Mimio digital whiteboard?
Mm-hmm. I'm good at selling Paul stuff.
I know.
Yeah. I've honed my Paul selling skills over the years we've done this podcast.
So
I like it when Carrington gets Paul to buy something during the show. Those are the favorites. Those are my favorites. It's happened.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Anyway, those are my choices.
Okay. Cool. Let's see. Am I next?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. I'll talk about this one. This is an Apple II keyboard repeater. It's a little device that you connect to your Apple II keyboard. And I think, I believe what it does is basically it's just auto repeat. So if you hold it down after a little while, it'll start repeating the key. But I thought this was kind of interesting actually, just because what it brings up is the fact that computers didn't always used to do this. This is a special thing. So more convenient than Apple's repeat key, standard on Apple III, IBM and most professional terminals, you know, but now you can get this on the Apple II also. And the Apple II and Apple II Plus actually had a key that was labeled repeat. And if you hold that down, then it would repeat the key. Oh, okay. And it it mentions that you can actually make this go two different speeds by using the add-on board and the repeat key.
Okay.
Then it will go twice as fast.
Nice.
Zip through text.
Okay, you're sleeping on two. If you go to the first photo, first of all, this has a great name because it's repeater with repeater. Four R's at the end.
Yes, we have to talk about the name.
But more than that, we have to talk about the subtle joke on the price sticker.
Oh, good eye. Nice.
Dollar sign appears twice, and that's hilarious.
That's so when I don't know if that was wrong.
Whoever sold this at that store and no one noticed your joke back in 1980, I see you.
Yes, we're here for you now.
Yeah.
Yes. Proprietor of Cincinnati Computer Store.
Yep.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, it says $$34.95.
Because that's exactly what I would have done if I was pricing things at Cincinnati Computer Store. I totally would have priced it that way. So I hope that joke, somebody just sat on that joke now for 30 years and we finally noticed it.
Yeah. This is from an old repair store. So, I mean, the seller might well have been the person who put that price tag
on. Nice.
I do like that they have sample usage in the description there. It's like sample output in the eBay description, and it just has a row of X's, and it says, it will do something like this. Thanks.
That's the person who would do that price tag.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Pretty sure we grokked it from the description, but I appreciate the sample output.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, a couple of the other things that I was going to talk about were from the cellar as well. But so go ahead, yeah. Blake, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say I've solved the mystery about the analog MSI joystick. Shall I reveal it?
Do it.
Sure.
Okay. So I found a open directory that has four photographs. It's a directory dedicated to this particular joystick. And what we see is there's a picture of the bottom of the board. This is with it open, and you see some colorful ribbon cables. Mm-hmm. There is also a picture of the top of the board, and you can see that there is the rainbow-colored connector. And apparently, if you take the bottom off the board, it disassembles. I guess the cable was inside, and it's got the standard, what is that, the Apple II 16-pin. Yeah. Is that 16-pin, Paul? The dip joystick connector. So, yes, I guess you need to pull the bottom off. Although it looks as if there might be
a little notch there, kind of
on the do you see the notch on the bottom? Carrington mm-hmm. saw what I was pointing at. Yeah, on the bottom plate, it looks like there might be a notch.
It does look like it.
Anyway, to let the cable out. But anyway, so
it's inside for shipping, I guess.
There's another dip connector, which I don't know what that would be about, but unpopulated, but.
See, my guess is that's so you can connect your project to it as well or something like that.
Yes, maybe. Anyway, I couldn't help but stop, to help solve the mystery. So.
Yeah, that's a very simple-looking device in there.
Yeah, yes.
But at the time, like in 79 or whenever, that would have been pretty cool because that stuff's hard to get. Like, nice switches and a nice joystick. Even now, if you want to buy an analog joystick for your hobby project, they're not that easy to get. Not
She's trying to sell you, Paul. Don't let her sell you. This is your time off.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. The next one I had, this is an Apple IIc. I find there's a couple of things about this auction. So it says vintage Apple IIc computer, A2S 4100, LaserWriter 2, ImageWriter 2, 5.5-inch disk drive, 5.25-inch disk drive. So one thing about this is that I don't think it jumps out particularly because the title says Apple IIc all smashed together with the number 2, right? So, I mean, like, you've got to have a pretty wide search to find this. The other thing that they don't mention, this auction, by the way, it's got 9 days left. The current bid is already up to about $158. It has one of these flat panel displays. This is a C view, so it's not the Apple one. But those are relatively sought after for the Apple IIcs. As an interesting device, you can actually sort of see, they have a photo of this thing working, and you can kind of see that they're not very usable. Mm-hmm. I think the CView might actually be better. This is CView is the brand.
It appears to be.
It might be a little bit better than the Apple made one, but they're pretty rough to read. I think we talked about this as like how suitable they'd be on the beach, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can't see it even in like optimal lighting conditions. Anyway, I thought it's interesting because I think the person who's selling this doesn't really have they didn't highlight the fact that it had this flat panel display, which
yeah, the current bid is a lot less than those displays go for by themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty impressive. Sure. Like this is a good find if somebody wants a 2C. That's a very nice complete system.
Also, if you're searching for a 2C. And you want a 2C rather than a 2C plus. My search back before when I wanted a 2C was for the A2S 4100. Most of the 2Cs, the original ones, are A2S 4000. And the 4100 has a much nicer keyboard. Like that's essentially the only difference between the two. And the original keyboard, the original Apple 2C is kind of crappy. And the one on the 2C plus is kind of amazing. And so this is the better keyboard version of the original 5.25-inch side floppy 2C. So this would be the one that I'd want too.
Yeah, this is a great buy actually at that price.
Mm-hmm. I was kind of curious. So they threw in the LaserWriter.
As one does.
Do you think, I mean, this actually, there's no way to connect that to the 2C, am I correct?
There were ways, yeah. So Geos could talk to LaserWriters. So there was some software that could do it, I think.
And also LaserWriters talked over AppleTalk. So you'd be able to put an AppleTalk dongle on your printer port, wouldn't you?
Yeah, maybe? Well, LaserWriters had serial too, didn't they?
They must have. I remember in A Plus magazine, there's an article by Paul Luddis, who did wrote Apple Rider 2, and he gave this. I don't know what the physical connection mechanism was, but he was giving control code methods of controlling PostScript in Apple Rider 2 to output, you know, borders and, you know, geometry on a laser writer if you wanted to fancy up your Apple Rider 2 document. And that he was definitely doing it on an Apple II pre-GS. So I don't know. I'm guessing it must have serial in, at least the early laser writers. This is not one of the earliest, I don't think.
Cool. So, yeah, so I think this is, if it's somehow sold as it stands, it is a pretty good deal. You have to figure out a place to put your Image Writer too. But
I wonder what the reserve is. Reserve not met.
Oh.
Yeah, that's true. This is one that has a reserve.
Right, but if they didn't mention the reserve, might be $1,000.
If they don't mention the LCD panel, then they clearly don't know what they've got. Because that's, I mean, you honestly, they should sell that separately, probably.
Yeah, they'd get more for it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. This I thought was cool. This is a Seiko UC2200 controller for the Seiko wearable computer system. Does this look familiar to you guys? So
it's the watch, right?
Yeah, the Seiko, what is it? UC2000 is a watch.
Yeah, I remember seeing commercials for this thing back in the day, that the computer-like attachment for the watch. Yeah.
Yeah, so there are sort of two sizes of the computer attachment. This one has a little printer, and it has a little dock that you put the watch on for when it's being programmed, and it has a place for application ROM packs and a full kind of like chiclet-type keyboard. It's a little bit yellowed. I think it actually started out somewhat yellowed. I think that's it's some kind of beige color to begin with. There's a slightly smaller version of this that is just sort of like a keyboard. It's sort of like a longer rectangle, and there are hilarious photos of people like wearing the whole thing on their wrist, you know, with the rectangle. But
Johnny Mnemonic.
So this does not come with the watch, but it does. It is. I thought it was actually kind of cheap. It's $80, and I think these probably come up like not at all.
Yeah, this thing's got to be rare. It's pretty cool, actually. If I had the watch, this would be really fun to have with it.
Yeah, it's almost tempting to get this and then look for the watch.
Yeah, the watch has come up regularly, but I don't think I've ever seen one of these for sale.
Yeah.
So what kind of things can you actually do with this watch? I'm not even familiar with it.
So it's got like a basic calendar, you know, alarms, that kind of stuff. Okay. Like the Casio calculator watch has had, you know, the ability to set a reminder for medications or, you know, basic appointment reminders, things like that.
Okay. And this, if you use this controller, you got a sort of a different interface to it to be able to sort of type things into it.
Yeah. Like you can type data in directly instead of having to program it by holding it up to your computer monitor and flashing lights at it very slowly, which was the other way to program them.
Neat.
Harrington started saying something which
might be this. Yeah, I found this same write-up which talks about the dawn of wearable computers and has a whole bunch of examples of this big one and the small one and some marketing and a whole bunch of things down below.
Oh yeah, right. This ad that's entirely in Japanese, which you can see the big keyboard one that has the printer in it, and then this longer one that actually you could conceivably put on your wrist. I can't remember. Somebody was making like a mocking. I think Blake has found the photo of like wearing the whole thing on your arm.
Yeah, it looks kind of like a Nintendo Power Glove sort of vibe coming off of that. Yeah, you don't mess with that fella when he comes into McDonald's.
That's right.
I got your Apple Watch right here.
Power in this person.
Yeah.
Continuing on, I had another thing which I thought was sort of interesting in that it basically came with the original Apple II. So it's, you know, it's, I don't know, whatever. It's kind
the
of
red manual.
It's typewritten notes. It was kind of like the first thing. They're actually surprisingly large. I mean, they're letter sized papers. It's weird when you have one in your hand because you're used to these kind of like small sized things, and you know, whatever they are, half sized or whatever. And so this, particularly when you see this Apple Computer Inc. Logo on the back, it just feels gargantuan. But anyway, these things go for a lot. This one seems to be in fairly good shape, and this person doesn't know what they have, I think. So it's a buy it now for $70, and I think that's actually kind of cheap for this book. So if you were looking for it and you are watching the stream right now, then you might want to buy it. I don't need it.
Isn't the red reference like a really sought after thing? I mean, it's quite valuable, very much more valuable than they're asking about. Am I right?
I believe so. I mean, like, maybe not very, very much, but yeah, it could sell for twice that probably.
I think it's come down since it's been, didn't somebody scan it and re-release it? I think David Grealish had something to do with that project from somebody, like you can get a remade one.
Yeah,
now.
Didn't Call Apple, didn't they re-release
yeah,
this?
Yeah, that's, I think it's Call Apple. I think you're right. Yeah.
Was it this one? Was it this book though? I think that was WASPAC.
Oh, that might be what I'm thinking of.
I can't read.
Which is kind of similar, but less organized. WASPAC is like the tech notes or whatever of the early Apple days. As I recall, it's just like a bunch of stuff kind of like jumbled together because they didn't have a manual, so they just gave that out.
Stream of consciousness.
Yeah. The next one I think I will mention is it's an IBM PC expansion unit. I think we might have talked about these before, but they are kind of rare. It looks exactly like a PC or a PC XT or something, but it's basically just an empty shell with slots that you connect to your PC or PC XT for extra cards or putting a hard drive in or something.
You stack them.
Yeah. So, let's see, I think they had a close-up of the badge. Yeah, IBM Personal Computer Expansion Unit.
I always thought they were so cool. See a stack, like to see that with the second unit on top.
Uh-huh.
It looks like you're definitely mean some serious computing business.
Yeah.
In other words, marketing figured out how to monetize a bunch of extra stock they had in cases.
Exactly.
It does kind of look like that, yeah. Though it does actually look like there's, it has the pieces you need to do the connection. If I am reading this right, you know, because it's just I guess you would call it a motherboard, but I mean, it really is like there's a nothing board inside that just has slots, but you do have cards that you connect to your actual PC.
So how do you connect that to your PC? Oh, just ribbon cables somehow.
Takes one slot in the actual PC, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, my guess is that one of these two cards that's sitting in there is the one that you take out and put in your actual PC. Mm-hmm.
Could be.
Like a bus extender kind of thing. And then it's got drive bays and it's got its own power supply. Jeez.
Yep. It is basically a PC without the PC part. But and this particular seller is asking $700 for it. So it's known to be somewhat rare, although that might be pushing it. Let's see. I think that actually exhausts the ones I need to talk about in this time frame. I will leave it at that. Quinn, do you have any?
I actually was looking stuff up while we were recording, just because since we talked about it. So I did some checking on eBay for Amiga books, and there's not much, unfortunately. I did find this one and one other similar one, Amiga for Beginners. So these are contemporary books from the period, which I guess is what contemporary means. And that's from my department of redundancy department. So books like this exist, and this seems like this would be actually a really great way for me to do what I'm trying to do. These are kind of the Amiga for Dummies books from the period. They are weirdly pricey, though. So the new retro book, the programming book that I mentioned at the top of the show, that was $18. So shipped to my door Prime for free. It'll be here tomorrow. This book is $54. So, and these are the kinds of books that at the time were just throwaway. Like you'd go into Barnes and Noble and there'd be a crappy, dusty rack of 1,000 of these variations of this book, and 99% of them were terrible. This kind of mass market, you know, pop computer book. So, it's hard to know if this one is any good. It's not like Amazon where you can look inside the book and see, you know, there's often not even pictures of the back, so you can't even tell what's in the book really. This one does have a picture of the back, which is nice, so I was able to kind of zoom in on it, and it does show, you know, this is kind of what I would want. Like, here's how you, you know, manipulate files, and here's how the command line works, and here's how to, you know, do the basics, how to boot it and so on, customize things and creating icons and the kind of basic usage stuff. So this could be a good way to go. But yeah, the price is turning me off a little bit. $54 seems like kind of a lot for something like this. So maybe I'll keep looking, but it's a good option.
There were a lot of those.
Do you think it comes with the disc? It's in the write-up on the back, it says it comes with the extras diskette. But
oh, that's interesting. I didn't notice that. Yeah, I would bet money that disc is long gone.
Hmm.
Yeah, but you can probably find it online.
See, I don't think the photo. Yeah, I don't think the seller did this on purpose. But the back of the book photo doesn't show the whole back of the book. It doesn't show the bottom, so you can't see the ISBN. And so if you can get that number, it makes it really easy to find other copies of a book.
Right. They might have done that on purpose, honestly. That's the kind of thing that eBay sellers do on purpose. But yeah, if you look at the related auctions, and there's just nothing in this category. Even I found one other book that was the original, like the Commodore book, the official Commodore 500 Amiga Beginner's Guide. And that somebody wanted $80 for that. So again, because it's an official book, it's going to be more expensive, more collectible. But that's a lot of money for these books.
Yeah, the Abacus books, I had a few for the Amiga. They would, some of them would just come with, like, Abacus / Data Becker were these, you know, companies that would publish. You know, there were a lot of the different books, and they were, you know, they're not super high quality print books. I mean, they're almost newsprint, and they all, usually came with the disc. I think half of them came with you know, like their version of the see Data Becker, their version of like an assembler. Like they'd throw in an assembler with a lot of the books, and it's pretty easy to find that online. It's a fine. I'm just saying the content is good. I'm just saying the build quality, so to speak, is it's certainly not, you know, anything on the high end of quality.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mass market book that's 40 years old. So yeah, I'm sure it's not great. But I do like this one covers Workbench 1.3 and Release 2.0. So, you know, it's sort of late in the cycle of this book. This is like a second or a third edition, at least. So the information will be a little more current. And it does mention command line stuff on the back. So, you know, this has a lot going for it. But $54. I don't know. Maybe I'll look for a scan.
I found one called the Computes Beginner's Guide to the Amiga. It's only $7 Canadian. Buy it now.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, the compute books were good.
Right.
All right, but that's all I had.
You can find that same book on Amazon for, it looks like, from like $4 to $13.
Oh, okay.
Al in our chat said found it for $4.19.
Nice. Okay. So, good to know. What's weird, because that didn't show up. Like, I searched Amazon for Amiga books, and none of this showed up. So that's pretty interesting. Something wrong with Amazon search on this topic.
Mm-hmm.
They're anti-Amiga, I guess, once again.
Typical.
Are we all?
I'm sure that's typical. Be
lighted by the search engine, even.
Damn it.
Yeah, it's funny. If you just search for Amiga, the book that I showed does not come up. I had to search, like, I searched for Amiga in the books department on Amazon. That book does not appear. I had to search for Amiga programming before that came up. Couldn't tell you why.
Al in the show notes said he searched on thrift books, which he had mentioned earlier in the show as well, that's his source when he goes to looking for old
books. Yes, I saw that. And actually, while we were recording, I looked on thrift books. They have a bunch of them listed, but none of them are in stock, except one. They had one of the kernel reference manuals, but they wanted $85 for it. So I'm not that interested in this.
Well, yeah, I don't find... Like, for these things, I really kind of find them interesting for the information and not for the artifact, you know? So
For something like this, if there's a good scan of it out there, that's fine. Like, I just want the information out of it.
And probably the author and the publisher, if they're even still, you know, around, have gotten whatever benefit they're going to get already. Yeah. Buying it from a third party is not going to give them anything.
Exactly. Plus, then I don't have a book that I have to deal with afterwards. Like, great, now I have this thing on my shelf that I have to move and pack and dust forever. So yeah, a good scan is preferable in a lot of ways, despite what I said earlier, whining about scans of these books.
Oh well, we are not all always consistent. Okay, I think we made it. Did we make it? Any other eBay auctions we needed to talk about?
We did. Okay.
Congratulations, everybody. We can now move to closing discussions. Blake, you have something written here.
Ah, okay. Closing discussion. I don't have a whole lot to mention. I will say, aside from the Parciero for the Amiga 1000 that I talked about and I'm playing with, I did receive a update I ordered for my Atari. I have a PAL Atari 800XL. It's I think, and we've talked about it here before, the Ultimate 1 Meg upgrade, which, and the reason I got it, it you put it in the system, it replaces the system ROM, and it attaches to the MMU of sorts that the system has, and basically it, turn it on, and it has a FPGA and, you know, storage, and it lets you load any of the ROMs that have ever existed for the Atari that are compatible in, including some custom ones. There's I bought it from I believe California-based group called the Brewing Academy that sells Atari upgrades, and they may sell other upgrades as well. I haven't used them before. I hear very good things about them, but the spent a little bit extra in the order to get this. There's a very wanted firmware from called the Jazzy Cat firmware that really makes it super nice. And the reason I got this, and also the reason I got the PAL 800XL to begin with, is to watch scene demos, demo scene productions on the Atari 8-bit, and a lot of them need, you know, they want like 320K or at least 128K, maybe more, and the 800XL I have has 64K, so you know, that's what that's about. And I think it was, you can get the device for like $70 from the source, but that involves shipping from somewhere in Europe. This was like $100 delivered, I think, from, you know, from the West Coast. So I will probably, well, depending on how the day goes tomorrow, install it for solder points, and that I should be good to go. So I'm sure I'll talk about that here at the next show.
All right. Well, good luck.
Yeah.
Carrington, any closing thoughts? Has your G4 gotten any closer?
Only retro thing I've been doing is I've opened my G4 iMac. I don't know if I had mentioned that last episode. Had I opened it yet back then? But I have, and it's amazing.
You had not.
I know I don't like to have a lot of stuff. Witness the emptiness behind me, the void that is my life. I'm thrilled with it. It's mm-hmm. so beautiful and so low. The keyboard is mushy and whatever, but it's great. I've been playing the current game we're playing for Eaten by a Group, the Infocom Arthur game, and it's fantastic. Like, I'm playing on this and I'm downloading tons of games and just pirating like crazy, and it's like the old days have returned. And I couldn't be happier with this thing. Like, it's amazing. It has the one problem it has, which is shared by a lot of G4 Macs, is the arm is a little loose, so it'll hold itself up or very low, but if you try to get like that 45 degree, it goes no, and it just drops. So I gotta figure out how to tighten that up, but I hear that's really difficult to do. It's some weird cabling thing inside, so we'll see. Right now it's I'm used to having taller monitors anyway, so I mostly just have it stuck straight up. It's a delight. I love it. Paul, you should buy one.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wait, cool. You have a bunch, but you should buy more.
Yeah,
I'm adoring it.
I believe that they are sort of notoriously hard to get into.
I have all the parts. I'm going to be doing a big upgrade. I was going to do it tonight, but it looks like I'm pushing it off to next weekend. So I'm going to be opening up, changing the RAM, putting in a new solid-state drive. I'm going to do the whole shebang at once, and so we'll see. I read through a thing on how to take it apart. Doesn't look that difficult. So I got it. I used to do stuff in this era all the time, so it should be fine. Or maybe I'll destroy it. Okay. Who knows? Nothing's meant to last.
Yeah. The thing I remember that worried me a little bit is having to sort of reapply thermal paste at some point in this process. You know? Yeah. But
I got it.
I mean,
no worries.
It's possible that, okay. I think that when I try to do this, what's going to end up happening is that I will then turn it on and it will just melt.
But, oh, it could be. I have the 2002 model of the 800 megahertz, I think it is. So it's the one that can still boot to OS 9 or Mac OS 9, which is what I got it booting to now. And that one seems easier to open up and make changes to than subsequent ones. The 17-inch monitor versions and the 20 seem to be, there's more paste involved, there's more things glued. So this is an easier one to open up, apparently. So we'll see. But it's got a battery in it that I really want to change. So that's the main thing. I want to get in there and make a change to that thing before it just is acid everywhere.
Nice.
That's it.
Okay, cool. Jack.
Yeah, well, I, like Blake, have also been in a little Atari 8-bit upgrade swing lately. I have the Ultimate 1 Megabit upgrade that I bought probably a year and a half ago and have never installed anywhere yet. And so I only very recently got around to actually opening up a couple of machines to figure out which one I want to install it in. Because some of the Atari 8-bits have things socketed, some everything's surface mount, some it's a mix. And so my 800XL that I opened up, it has some things socketed, but not everything. Notably, the ROM chip seems to not be socketed. Mm-hmm. Whereas I opened up my 600XL, and there everything was socketed. And I already had a 64K upgrade for that ready to install. So I installed that, and will next install the Ultimate 1 Meg right there. So, and it's a PAL 600XL, so it should be good for all of these demos as well. So. Nice. Cool. So it's kind of fun to actually do something that I've been I bought the Ultimate 1 Megabyte upgrade and the 64K upgrade for the 600XL at the same time, like a year and a half ago, and have not done anything with them yet. And I bought them both from Lotharek, the guy in Poland who's the creator of these things.
Yeah.
He's the one who sells them onto the Brewing Academy. They buy them from him. But for me, in Europe, the shipping is nice, so it works out. Yeah, so anyway, that's kind of fun just to have to finally be moving on this thing that I've been planning to do for a long time. It's actually happening. And also, for Christmas, I received this incredible Nixie Tube clock for my girlfriend. Cool. And it's a kit, so I had to assemble this. There's a lot of soldering involved. Extreme close-up.
Nice.
And I think I can hit a very button nice to make it switch to the seconds display. Maybe not. I don't know what I did. I did something.
Wow.
This thing's
something
is blinking. 2 seconds going.
There we go.
Yeah. And so it has like a blue backlight, and the numbers themselves are this kind of nice red. And if you flip to the back, you can see. So there are two circuit boards sandwiched together. I had to solder everything onto these. I made some mistakes, but I got it all working eventually, and I'm very happy with this thing. It's cool.
I like the side of the case is kind of like a 40s deco, you know, kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Is the case pressed metal or is that plastic? That's plastic.
It's metal. This is aluminum.
Oh, wow. Aluminum. Yeah. Oh, that's a really nice, sharp looking thing.
Yep. Yeah. So it's really nice. And you can buy this. So you can buy it, the kit, and you can buy the case, or you can just buy the kit. It's all, you can sort of pick and choose from the seller. It's a company called PV Electronics, an English company.
Wow. And it's a beautiful case.
Yep. It's really nice. And it was fun to put together. It took me, I don't know, probably 5 or 6 hours altogether. And I started this too late in the evening, but once I was going, I couldn't stop. So I was up until probably 2 in the morning on a Tuesday or something, but it was so much fun. I couldn't stop.
Super cool.
Nice.
Very exciting.
Yeah, actually, you were speaking of all these, you know, Atari something XLs. The word from our sponsor, I believe that we're using, is the Convincer ad for the Atari 1200 right. XL, which has like a regular keyboard on it. I was surprised actually how big that thing looked. I mean, I thought these things were little, but the 1200 XL looks like it's actually almost Apple II size.
Oh yeah, it's big. Really nice keyboard. The 1200 XL, I think, is the best keyboard of any of the XLs, right? Am I right?
That's what people say. Yeah. I've never actually used one, but people say the 1200 XL keyboard is very good.
Yeah, beautiful keyboard.
So, but they're huge. Yeah. They're really deep, and it is almost Apple II deep. Not quite, but it's I don't know, well over half the way there, if not 2/3 the way there. They're big.
Yeah. That, by the way, is something of a commercial. Yeah. I mean, like that. I hate that Atari. The Atari representative is just like someone I would hate in my life.
Horrible. It's a horrible commercial with a horrible protagonist. Antagonist, really. He's antagonizing other people, other computers.
Taking the little things off the Commodore's shoulder and eating the apple.
We don't dislike Ataris. We dislike Atari people.
It's the people.
Boo Atari is short for Boo Atari People.
Boo Atari Corporation.
Yeah.
Don't tweet at me.
Let's see. I had what about me? It's not actually a whole lot going on for me because I'm reaching the end of the break time and it's getting to be kind of tight time wise. But I am packing things and
I was gonna say, how's your move going?
Well, it's very slow. We're sort of moving to this condo, but over over a month or two. So, I mean, it's you know, we're moving all the easy stuff early, feeling like we've accomplished something, and then when it gets to be the last few hours, we will realize that actually what we have left is the hardest part. That is always what happens. But so yeah, I am thinking a little bit about how I might arrange all my many computers around my new desk in the new space, and we'll see how that goes. Some negotiations on aesthetics are no doubt pending.
No doubt. No doubt.
So, Quinn, any closing notes?
Not a lot. I said on the last episode I was looking forward to playing a bunch of Nox Archaeist. That did not happen, so I fear the fade may have started. Nothing wrong with the game. I just, as I said before, just don't have time for these kinds of games anymore. It's such an investment of hours, and I have to budget my time so carefully these days. So we'll see. But now very shortly this new Amiga book will be arriving, so I look forward to not having time to read that. Maybe I'll report back on that on the next show, but if not, well, it'll also be more of nothing.
Excellent.
If these shows weren't 3 hours long, I might have time to do some of this stuff every week.
Yeah, I do think about that sometimes. I also think about that in the editing process.
Yeah, but, I was going to say.
All right, good, excellent.
We should do this like a chess clock thing. Whenever we're talking, we press the button, but we each only have so much. I can't tell you my eBay things.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Not a bad idea.
Paul can start getting mean to us.
That's a good idea.
I think, I don't know if I've probably suggested this before, but I always thought it would be kind of a funny idea too. Like, particularly in like a conference situation where someone is talking and they need to stop, is to put them on like a platform, either a platform that lowers or in front of a lectern that goes up so that eventually like you just can't see them anymore.
Their mic volume just slowly drops.
Yeah. <That's good. laughs> But yeah, anyway, excellent. Well, nevertheless, it is an entertaining, you know, 3 hours every couple weeks. It is. So
for us we have fun. I don't know about the listeners, but
yeah. Right. This is the only socializing I get now, so yeah. I'm happy for it.
That's right.
The listeners are all Atari people and they're mad at us.
That's right.
They're seriously tweeting at me right now.
Perfect.
Don't tweet at me.
All right. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And please write a review on iTunes. That's still in the show notes. I don't know. Do it if you want. we will read them someday. And until next time,
Retro Compute. I'm not waiting. I'm going in. Making this happen.
Yep, I'm good.